It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. A special visit coming up from Cory Doctorow. He's got a brand new Kickstarter you're going to want to know all about. We'll also talk about the assault on libraries from publishers. We'll talk about ChatGPT with our other guests, Ian Thompson from The Register, Georgia Dow, the psychotherapist, and Renee Ritchie of YouTube. We'll also talk about the TikTok ban and a whole lot more. Plus, Mr. and Mrs. Pickles have a baby. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech, episode 920, recorded Sunday, March 26th, 2023. Biological bootloaders. This Week in Tech is brought to you by ACI Learning. Tech is one industry where opportunities outpace growth, especially in cybersecurity. One-third of information security jobs require a cybersecurity certification. To maintain your competitive edge across audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness, visit go.acilearning.com/twit. And by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/twit and book a demo today. And by Noom. Stop chasing health trends and build sustainable, healthy habits with Noom's psychology-based approach. And check out Noom's first ever book, The Noom Mindset, a deep dive into the psychology of behavior change, available to buy now wherever books are sold. And sign up for your trial at noom.com/twit. And by Shopify. Shopify makes it simple to sell to anyone from anywhere. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period to get your business to the next level today. Visit shopify.com/twit, all lowercase. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news, this time with three Canadians, two Brits, and two Americans, which sounds like a very large seven-person panel, but it's just five of us, but we got one guy who's really throwing the averages off. Cory Doctorow is here. He is both a Canadian by birth, a Brit by dual passport, right?
Yes, and an American by triple passport.
Did you have to take the American citizenship? Didn't you have to renege the others?
No, I just had to forswear loyalty to foreign potentates.
Oh, all right. So let's all be clear. He has forsworn any loyalty to foreign potentates. However, his loyalty to the U.S. is maybe in a little bit in question. We'll get to that in a second.
I also had to promise to carry a gun for America if need be. But given that I'm a 51-year-old man with two artificial hips and cataracts, it seems unlikely I'm going to get drafted.
To get citizenship, you have to say I would be willing to bear arms for the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, another naturalized citizen. Hello, Mr. Naturalized Citizen Ian Thompson, U.S. Editor of the Register.
I'm not an American citizen yet, but I am considering it. But Cory is absolutely right. When you look through when you're going through the citizenship test, they will say, you can be drafted to serve in the defense of the United States. And it's like, my God, if they're that down on the list, they're coming for someone like me. Good luck.
There's actually,
well, I'll be able to outrun them at that point if they're scraping that bottom of the barrel. They won't catch me.
Hey, Russia did. It could happen. Given your Slavic heritage, you too could be conscripted by Putin's army.
So I can get a Russian passport, a Belarusian passport, and an Azerbaijani passport as well.
Holy
I have not
cow.
Gotten those. I have no desire to travel to countries where they've had an ethnic purge or anything.
Yeah,
and
no,
I don't know what else I'd
idea.
Use those passports for.
Yeah.
Well, this was quite a problem when I was going for citizenship, because my sister was born in what was then Northern Rhodesia, is now Zambia. My father was born in what's now the capital of Pakistan, who was then the British Empire of India. And it was like, just put British Empire of India down on the form. That way they're not going to argue about it.
Well, where'd the Scotland part come in?
Oh, my dad's always been a Scot.
Oh, right.
Scots move everywhere. We engineer the world. We built the San Francisco cable car system, the Golden Gate
That's right.
Park.
That's right.
know, this is what we do.
I haven't even gotten to the end of the line, but I do have two people who cannot be drafted by the United States, at least. From Montreal, Canada, I have Renee Ritchie, creator liaison at the YouTube. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Leo. I am not a cat. I'm still not a cat.
Still not a cat.
But I am here.
And it's wonderful to see you, longtime host on for more than a decade on MacBreak Weekly. We miss you, but you're doing such good work. Stopping the swearing on YouTube. We really appreciate all you. All
no,
you
starting it again.
Oh, yeah. Restarting the profanity. Yes. It's great to have you. And your next door neighbor is here, Georgia Dow. Hi, Georgia.
Hello.
YouTube star Georgia Dow. Also a licensed psychotherapist, should anybody feel the need. It's great to have you. Wow.
Nice to be here.
A lot of people here, but I want to start with Corey because he can't stay the whole show. But I did want to mention his new Kickstarter, Corey, Red Team Blues. What's this about?
Yeah, so this is my next novel. It's the first book in a trilogy. It's about a guy called Marty Hench, who's a 67-year-old hard-charging forensic accountant. He's been in Silicon Valley for 40 years, unwinding tech scams. And it's his last job. He gets pulled in by a friend who's a legendary cryptographer who unwisely built a backdoor for his cryptocurrency, which has now escaped into the wild. Marty has to recover the keys, which turns out to be the easy part. Then he ends up caught between a three-way war between narcos, money launderers, and rogue three-letter agencies. And what it really is it's like an anti-finance finance novel. It's a novel about the kind of bitter disappointment of an internet that once held the promise of technical liberation and has become a place of technical control and extraction. And it was a fun book to write. I wrote it in 6 weeks flat. The last book I did like this, it was Little Brother. I gave it to my wife. I rolled over at 2 a.m. the next night. She was sitting up in bed and I was like, what are you doing? And she said, well, I just had to find out how it ended. Now, my publisher 3 days later bought this book and 2 sequels. They're going to run in reverse chronological order. So this is his last mission. We go all the way back to his first in the 1980s through the next 2 books. And they're you know, swept all of the trades. It's got starred reviews in all the trade magazines. But the one thing is that as with all my books, Amazon Audible will not sell the audiobook because there's no DRM on it. And so I am kickstarting a DRM-free edition. I go into the studio tomorrow with Will Wheaton here in LA, and we are going to record a really fantastic audiobook, as has been every one of the audiobooks Will's recorded with me. And the Kickstarter pre-sells the audiobook, the hardcover, the ebook, DRM-free, obviously. And I think in addition to being a way to, you know, fund this independent production and treat Amazon as damage and route around it, it's also a way to show other people that, you know, you don't have to submit to the bullying tactics and lock-in of a monopolist just to reach your audience.
I love the URL for this is kickstarter.com/project/doctorow/Red Team Blues, another audiobook that Amazon won't sell.
Yeah. Although the short URL is just Red Team Blues. That'll just forward you there. Redteamblues.com. We'll just forward you there. But yeah, I mean, Amazon won't sell my audiobook. So,
no, really, Corey, you know, let's be fair. Is it that Amazon won't sell it or that you won't allow them to sell it?
Well, I went to Amazon and said, you can sell my audiobooks. Just don't put DRM on them, as you promised you wouldn't when you bought Audible.
Because when
they bought Audible, they said they were getting rid of the DRM.
Audible's always had DRM. It's not hard to strip it off, but they've always had DRM. And I always just assumed it was the publishers that insisted on it. There are audiobook stores
Audible
that don't have a DRM on it.
That's right. Well, all of them except for Audible and Apple Books, which is a front end for Audible, allow you to choose whether there's DRM. The thing about this DRM, and this kind of resolves the mystery, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 1201, it is more illegal for you to remove DRM from an audiobook that I made with my blessing than it is for you to pirate that audiobook, right? If I give you the tool to remove DRM from my audiobook that I made and paid for, I commit a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine for a first offense. The maximum penalty, civil and criminal, for making an infringing copy of that book is only $400,000. Wow. And so, you know, it is obvious when you put it that way why Amazon would want to make sure that they have DRM in all the books, because it means that if someone offers me more money for my audiobooks to take my books off Audible and sell them somewhere else, I have to bet that my audience is willing to throw away all the audiobooks they've ever bought to follow me to a rival platform because I can't authorize them to remove the DRM, and Amazon's not going to send me a list of all my customers so I can send them free download codes for another platform. So I'm just stuck, right? So I've always had this position that I'm just not going to be bait in a sticky trap. And here we are, you know, more than a decade after Amazon purchased Audible. It's now 90% of the audiobook market. And they are engaged in rampant wage theft. The Audiblegate scandal accounted for at least $100 million in wage theft from independent audiobook creators. And still not giving creators the choice about whether they want to lock their listeners to Amazon's platform, not just for the term of copyright, which is 90 years on these commercial works, but forever.
DRM, I should just explain, is copy protection, digital rights management for people who don't want to fire up Wikipedia and look it up.
It's an encryption scheme. It doesn't work very well because the way that
it works
is
easy to strip off. Frankly.
Yeah, I scramble the book and then I give you the book with a player that has the key to unscramble it. And then I bet that you're never going to figure out where in that player I hid the key. Yeah. The technical term for this in security research is wishful thinking. So, you know, it's not like a thing that stops people from pirating audiobooks. You don't need to strip DRM off to pirate audiobooks. You just type, you know, book name space MP3 free download pirate into your favorite search engine. You can just get it, right? The only thing this does is prevent actual proprietors, creators, and publishers from creating legitimate legal businesses that present alternatives to Amazon and would discipline Amazon in its dealings with creators and with audiences, because Amazon's now sticking ads in the audiobooks you pay for, you know, which again is just, and if they can control what player you listen to, they can stop you from skipping ads.
You just explained, by the way, why the record industry is going after ISPs now. And even worse, when after Quad 9, a DNS resolver, they can't stop the piracy. So what they want to do is stop you from finding the pirate sites. They actually won their case. I was shocked. They won their case against Quad 9.
It's, you know, I think that the lesson of the streaming services has been that if you give people a reasonable offer at a reasonable price, they'll choose it. I think the other lesson in the streaming services is that no one ever bought a book or a record because they wanted an entertainment executive to make more money. And so, you know, if we show people that there is an equitable arrangement, people will opt into it. And the people who won't, we're never going to opt into it. It's the you know, I don't compete with piracy. I compete with all the things you could do that aren't listening to an audiobook, playing games, you know, going for a walk in the park, Zooming, looking at websites with names that we can't mention because it's a family-friendly show. You know, all of those things are my competitors. And the piracy is like on the list of things that cause people not to listen to my books. You know, piracy is way down there in terms of what I compete with.
And yet, publishers are working hard, well, now to put libraries out of existence. See, we talked last week.
Internet Archive.
Yeah, we talked last week about Internet Archive, which lost its case this week in a lower court ruling for what it calls, cloud library distribution.
It's controlled digital lending.
Controlled digital lending, CDL.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yep. CDL. Yeah.
So just a bit, let me make sure I understand what was happening. So the Internet Archive, which is the Wayback Machine, it's archive.org. It's really the library of the Internet and a really valuable resource for everybody. In fact, they actually bought and housed themselves in a old library building in San Francisco. Near Golden Gate Park. It's just beautiful. So
a church, actually.
It's a church, but it's got columns. Church. It looks like, I don't know, I imagine the Library of Alexandria must have looked like.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I guess it's a church. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But they were taking books, often donated by libraries, old used books that the library was going to replace, and digitizing them. Mm-hmm. Making ebooks out of the paper books and then lending them out and lending them out just as a library does, where it's like they have one copy and two people can't check out the same copy. So, and that's how libraries do it as well. But the publishers have sued Was it now? Are they suing over that, or was it the fact that they relaxed restrictions in COVID?
That's what they're suing over. It's not about the relaxed restrictions. I have to be really careful here because I work with Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we are counsel for the archive. I want to be really clear that anything I say about this case is me speaking personally and not speaking on behalf of EFF. I'm a contractor to them, not an employee, but I'm still part of the organization. So, I mean, it's a very nuanced question about copyright law, but for me, there's this like very bottom line idea, which is that libraries are really old. Libraries are not just older than copyright or publishing. They're older than books and paper, right? Libraries have been around since we had scrolls of papyrus, and they're older than commerce as we understand it. And the idea that we have made a technological change, not more profound than the technological changes we made when we went from papyrus to paper or scrolls to codexes or, you know, from books copied by scribes to books that were printed, that the idea that somehow digital is so profoundly different that we just say, okay, well, you can lend out books that are copied by monks, but you can't lend out books that are represented on hard drives because we are just in a new world. To me, that is, it's not just ghastly in terms of how it makes me feel about a future for my family as a writer and an artist, but also as someone who believes in public goods and access to human knowledge. I fear for it as someone who cares about books, because, you know, one of the things about books is that they do have this kind of penumbra of antiquity and virtue, where like if you're making a dumb student film and you want to show society's collapse, you just put a pile of books together and you set fire to them. And people are like, oh yeah, it's like eating dogs or something. That's like wrong. We know everything has gone wrong. And if you just convince people that books are just like another widget, that they're like a Happy Meal toy, people might in fact take you at your word and like stop buying books just so they can be surrounded by them, and stop giving people books as a way of showing them how special they are to them, and stop thinking about books in this kind of wonderful way that is such a source of revenue to writers and publishers. You know, if I have a healthy retirement, it'll be as much because of that as because of anything I ever wrote. And I really worry that you have this idea that we should just treat publishing like another business, like we could treat, you know, your puppy as just another source of protein. And, you know, if we do that, I think the worst thing that could possibly happen is that we'd succeed.
Leah Holland of Fight for the Future said, in a chilling ruling, a lower court judge in New York has completely disregarded the traditional rights of libraries to own and preserve books in favor of maximizing the profits of big media conglomerates. And Tech Dirt, I think it probably was Mike Masnick, wrote that this is really just a straw man. The publishers have wanted to get rid of libraries all along, and this case is just one step forward in their goal. Of course, the Internet
Archive. Library today.
Yeah.
You couldn't start a library today. No way.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
yeah.
You know, if libraries didn't exist and you tried to found one, they'd be like,
we can't do that.
Shut up, commie.
You can't do that. Give away books.
What commie came up with this idea? Thomas Jefferson? Benjamin Franklin?
What the hell was wrong with him? They will appeal. Internet Archive, Brewster Kahle will appeal, of course. And I imagine this is going to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, I don't have high hopes of the Supreme Court understanding the risks here. Maybe they would.
Yeah. I mean, the dirty secret about Ruth Bader Ginsburg is, as good as she was on other issues, she wasn't good on copyright.
Yep.
Copyright's a weird issue that people split in a million ways on. I think that, like, as much as there are elements of copyright that I depend on for my living, there's parts of it that are structured so badly that they actually get in the way, right? Like this, like the fact that we have a copyright law that says that Amazon can put DRM in my books and then I can't authorize you to remove it is a problem with copyright.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, it's, you know, when people say, don't you like copyright? You have to be really specific. Like, what part of copyright are you asking me about?
Well,
the parts that get me paid are great.
You've always been, and it's really great because you are an author, you make your living off of writing. You've always been very clear that you don't need that to make a good living off of writing, and that you're happy to offer your books through Creative Commons and even free downloads on your website.
I've done that too. But also, like, if you told me that my copyright would endure for my life in 50 years instead of my life in 90 years, I wouldn't write fewer books.
Right.
And, you know, I was just, in fact, negotiating a contract with someone to do some work with my work. and we had this question about whether certain uses would be reserved to them if I wanted to repurpose it in the future. And I said, like, this is fine, except that what we're ultimately talking about is that if I give my copyrights over to a library on my death, your grandchildren could sue that library over how it chooses to preserve it, right? That is like, and that's a giant X factor that plays up in many ways, right? We had Stephen Joyce, the grandson of James Joyce, refusing to allow scholars to research Joyce's work because he didn't like how they characterized Joyce's work, and Joyce scholarship languished for years. You had Warner Music conjuring up fanciful stories out of the distant past to say that they own the lyrics to Happy Birthday, and shaking down restaurants and movies and all kinds of places if they tried to sing Happy Birthday in public. That's why when you go to like TGI Fridays, they had these weird birthday songs that like Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. It was like they didn't want to pay Dane geld to Warners, right? So, you know, like there are lots of elements of this. You know, a little goes a long way, and we need to attend to the actual like distributional outcomes, right? When you tweak copyright in this way, who does it make richer and who does it make poorer? And I think a copyright that benefits artists is something I can get behind, but one that moves most of that benefit to, say, intermediaries like libraries or like publishers or distributors or digital platforms, I don't think that's serving any kind of artistic purpose. I think that's just rent seeking.
We've spoken a lot about Corey's fantastic blog post on insurtification, which is what I call it. This ties into that. I also want to send people to the website battleforlibraries.com. This is a site where you could sign a petition and find out more. And you really should find out more, because we want to save not just the Internet Archive, which, by the way, all by itself is well worth saving, but every library in America. So
I can't speak for the other participants, but I've got to say, I would not be in the career I'm in if it wasn't from our public library.
Yeah.
You know, I spent entire summers in there. I went, when I took my wife back to the UK, we went to my old library just to smell the books and, you know, enjoy the feeling. They're still running the same literacy courses that I took, which started me on the road to being a journalist. They're an incredibly important resource.
Yeah.
It's the last institution that in every town where you're valued because you're a person and not because you got something in your wallet.
Love it.
The last place.
Yeah. Well, you do have something in your wallet, your library card, but that's that's worth
but
getting.
If you don't have one, they'll give you one.
They'll give you
one.
They
so
give
you
it
don't
to
even
you.
Have to have one.
Yeah, they give it to you. Right.
They'll put it in your wallet for you.
Corey's book is right now on Kickstarter. This would be a very good time to sign up for Red Team Blues, another audiobook that Amazon
comes
wants
out from Macmillan in on the 25th.
Nice.
So I'll be touring the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and Germany.
And I could see Brad Pitt as Marty Hench, forensic CPA.
Yeah, it's the story of a man and his coin, Leo.
Easily,
it's a man and his coin.
A man and his coin. They're going to option this one, especially this is the new James Bond. This is going to be. Albert Broccoli is going to be on the phone any day now. I can tell you right now.
But the other kind
thank
of bond,
you.
The financial bond.
I would settle for a lesser zucchini. I don't need the broccoli. It's mine.
Corey, I'll let you head to the airport. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks,
another
guys.
Time,
I
when
really
you got some more time,
it.
I'd love to get back on about
I
SVB.
Love that.
The financialization thing. You know, this is yet another. I don't know how you live without heartburn. And because everything is so outrageous that's going on, and this is just another outrage.
Well, I write when I'm anxious. I have 7 books in production that will give me lots of chances to show up on your show and talk about them.
Brandon Sanderson writes because he's Mormon. You write because you're anxious.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. I'll talk to you
thank
later.
Thank you,
guys.
Corey Doctorow. Really
Bye.
Appreciate it. RedTeamBlues.com, Pluralistic.net for his blog. Well worth it. Marty Hench knows where Silicon Valley's bodies are buried. By the way, it's just a great page. If you go to the Kickstarter, you can see Will Wheaton, who's reading the book tomorrow, as you saw. You can see the people producing it. There's a lot of great stuff on this page. And he's reaching his goal already. He wants 15,000. He's got 83,000. But there's no reason for you not to join the 1,961 backers and get yourself a copy. It's great. Always great to have Corey on. But we also know that Corey talks a lot. So I wanted to make sure that we had time for Renee Ritchie, Georgia Dow, and Ian Thompson. So I've done my penance for allowing Jason Calacanis on the show a couple of weeks ago. Now I'm back in God's good graces. We're going to take a little break.
Speaking all caps or...
It was right after that, right? But problem is, I love him as a person, and I understand why he's kind of become villainized as the personification of the evil angel investor.
He was the first person ever to DM me on Twitter, I think, because we were on the show together.
Yeah,
years and years ago.
And he's a great person to have on the show because he's a character and he's funny and he's interesting and he's got a provocative personality. It's all in uppercase, no matter what, even on the podcast.
I mean, he's a lovely chap, personally. I've done his podcast a couple of times, and it's, you know, but it was kind of special pleading. And you're like, if we're going to stand up and be entrepreneurs, then stand up and be entrepreneurs. Don't ask the government to bail you out.
Well, and I think Corey had a lot to say about this, but it's, you know, it's when it's bailing the people out, it's socialism. When it's bailing the companies out, it's capitalism. And
there's no libertarians in a bank crisis. Is that what they say?
Like, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Let's take a little break. We'll come back with the rest of the story. In fact, there's a lot of news, which we will get to with a fantastic panel today. A bunch of Canadians and a Brit. Georgia Dow.
Have our own Commonwealth Games.
Renee Ritchie. Yeah, it's the Commonwealth Games right here.
If only you hadn't turned away the Queen. Honestly, it's just shameful.
And Ian Thompson. I'm listening to Spare right now. And you know, at first I said, I don't want to give any money to Harry, and you know, because it's just, it's all ginned up soap opera anyway. But then I thought, well, here's a rare opportunity. Most of the time when a royal biography or autobiography comes out, it's hagiography. It's not real, right? You know, I wouldn't expect Prince Charles to write the true story of what it's like to be Prince Charles. But Prince Harry is kind of on the outs. I think he's ready to tell the truth. So I thought, I want to hear what it's like to be.
Wouldn't it be more boring, though? I went to In-N-Out for the third time this week. I hate myself.
There's a little bit of this. At one point, his penis is frostbitten. I thought that was interesting. That's not something King Charles is going to mention.
If that happened during his helicopter tour in Canada, then that's just stereotypical.
No. He actually was on his way to the North Pole, and then he did the South Pole. He's actually a very interesting fellow, but he makes a very strong case against the British tabloid press. You know, he believes, and I think it's the case, that his mother was killed by them, by paparazzi chasing her into a tunnel, and the reason he and Meghan Markle left the UK was because they couldn't lead a normal life. And so I thought it was interesting to read that. I wanted to see what it was like. And now
I'm tempted to look at it because, you know, it is an inside story. On the Diana thing, Occam's razor. You know, one person survived that car crash, and it's the one person that was wearing a seatbelt.
Well, absolutely. The seatbelts would have saved them. That's not a question. But the reason they were speeding down that Parisian tunnel was they were trying to get away from paparazzi.
Chased. Yeah.
Yeah. On motorbikes.
And if you looked at Harry's face at the actual funeral procession for her and the look he gave the press, it was utter loathing, and I can quite understand why.
Yeah.
Because, yes, they did cause the incident.
Yeah. And he calls Rupert Murdoch one of the most vile influences on the world in history, and I think he may not be far wrong. So there's some interesting... spot on. So there's some interesting...
Well, you saw he just got engaged this week.
For his fourth time,
92 years old, and it was.
You know,
like,
what I liked his line.
What first attracted you to billionaire?
I love the line. His new wife is in her 70s. What the line Rupert Murdoch said is, "I wanted somebody to spend the second half of my life with." Is he living to 184? What is the plan here? Anyway.
Honestly, he'd obviously love
God bless
to.
Him. But, you know. Yeah, God bless him. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Anyway, we will continue our conversation about the royals and everything else. Ian Thompson from The Register, ladies and gentlemen. But first, let's talk to you about the people who sponsor this fine studio, the great folks at ACI Learning. You may say, well, who are they? You know them. For the last decade, our partners at IT Pro have been so great in bringing you engaging and entertaining IT training to level up your career, to bring your organization up to snuff. Well, now IT Pro is part of ACI Learning. And by partnering with ACI Learning, they are bringing you an incredibly expanded reach, brand new production capabilities, brand new content, and a chance to learn in a mode and a style that fits your personality and your stage of development. With IT Pro and their on-demand courses, there's Audit Pro, there's Practice Labs, there's even learning hubs with ACI Learning, so you can go and learn in person, and you can mix and match as well. Whether you're at the very beginning of a career or looking to move up in your sector, ACI Learning is here to support your growth, and not just in IT, but in audit readiness, as I said, but also in cybersecurity. You know, one of the best-known certs, the cert that almost everybody getting into IT gets, is that CompTIA A+ certification. The CompTIA courses from ACI Learning are amazing. They make it easy to go from daydreaming about a career in IT to launching it. And the key here is earning certificates open the doors to most entry-level IT positions. You need the cert because otherwise they go, well, who are you? Well, I've been fixing computers for years. Yeah, but how do I know you've got the knowledge? Well, I got an A+. Oh, okay. You took the time, the trouble to study, to take the test, and I know you've got the knowledge. You're hired, right? It's really that easy. But it not only does it get you in the entry-level positions, but those certs and later certs get you promotions, allow you to move laterally into a new area of IT. IT is great because it's constantly changing. Tech is one industry where opportunities outpace growth, and that's especially true in cybersecurity. LinkedIn just did a study that predicted IT jobs would be the most in-demand roles in 2023. I'm not surprised. About a third of information security jobs require a cybersecurity cert. 23% of all IT jobs require a cert. While organizations are hungry for cybersecurity talent, there's a huge gap, more than 1 million unfilled jobs this year alone. That's probably why the average salary for cybersecurity specialists, $116,000. ACI Learning's Information Security Analyst and Cybersecurity Specialist programs are two tracks that can help get you certified and get you a great job. And I was talking about that gap. Last year, the gap between the positions that needed to be filled and the number of people to fill them increased by 26.2% compared to 2021. And that means there's a lot of open jobs and a lot of opportunity for you. All you need is that cert. ACI Learning offers multiple cybersecurity training programs to prepare you to enter or advance within this exciting industry. CISSP, EC Council Certified Ethical Hacker, Certified Network Defender. You got Cybersecurity Audit School. That's getting bigger and bigger all the time. Companies have to prove, you know, that they're doing the right thing in security, cybersecurity frameworks. By the way, when I say companies, this is important. They have great plans for businesses that want to upskill their IT departments. And I bet you any business, if you're running a business and you're thinking about this, you know you need some cybersecurity experts. Why hire out when you could give IT Pro from ACI Learning to your team and they could upskill, and now they have the certs and the skills you need to protect your business. It's that easy. Where and how you learn matters. ACI Learning offers fully customizable training for all types of learners, in person, on demand, remote. You could take your learning beyond the classroom with their labs. Explore everything ACI Learning offers. IT Pro, Audit Pro, that includes enterprise solutions, webinars, the Skeptical Auditor podcast, Practice Labs, Learning Hubs, their partnership program, and of course the great Technado podcast Don Pezet does from IT Pro. That just had its 300th episode. Congratulations, Don. This is a great time to get into tech. It's the one industry where the opportunities are outpacing growth, particularly cybersecurity. That's a job that will take you to the moon. You can really, really grow with. One third of information security jobs require a cybersecurity cert. Maintain your competitive edge against audit, IT, and cybersecurity readiness. Here's the website, go.acilearning.com/twit. Say no more. go.acilearning.com/twit. We have a special offer code, TWIT30. That gets you 30% off a standard or premium individual IT Pro membership. go.acilearning.com/twit. Twit. We thank them so much for their support of the show and your support for the show by using that address and that offer code, TWIT30. Normally we end the show with obituaries. This is an important one. I wanted to begin the show with the passing of Gordon Moore. He of Moore's Law, founder of Intel, age 94. Story from the Register with this quote, "Impossible to imagine the world we live in today without his contributions." It's funny because
last of the Troll Crusade. So, you know, Shockley was an engineer who drove the industry, but was an absolute, I'm not going to say the word, but the traitorous eight started their own chip companies.
That's such a great story.
We have the world we have.
Yeah. So Shockley in the 50s, 1956, was the first microprocessor company. And Robert Noyce was there. Gordon Moore was there. Six other engineers joined them, left the traitorous eight, I love that, to found Fairchild Semiconductor. And Fairchild, then throughout the 60s, in 1968, Moore joined Noyce and Andy Grove, and they founded Intel. And really, without this guy, Gordon Moore, I don't know what the tech world would look like. He was very much a part of the microprocessor revolution.
Silicon Valley would still be full of orange trees. You know what I mean?
It was prune
Apple
orchards.
Park would still be a park.
They were actually prune orchards, believe it or not. Not orange trees. That's down south. And I know that because the big mall in Silicon Valley is called the Prune Yard, which if you didn't know is prune orchards, you might say that's not a great name.
No, it provides the idea of movement, but yes.
Yes. Move on through
Tarantino
the prune yard.
If Tarantino was ever going to do a Silicon movie, it would be Traitorous 8. Just a perfect title.
Oh, it would be, you know what, that would be, the story is amazing. That would be a great movie. I'd like to see that. Moore, of course, most famous for Moore's Law, and of course every obituary leads with Moore's Law. He was kind of embarrassed that it was called Moore's Law.
It wasn't a law. It was an engineering prediction based on solid science. But I know what you mean. I mean, back when Intel was doing Intel developer forums, we'd take a sweepstake among the foreign journalists how long it would be before they mentioned Moore's Law.
Yeah.
And it never went over 10 minutes. You know, you had to get in there really early to win the prize.
It's kind of like Godwin's Law, where, you know, you just know the conversation's going to get there. His observation was that the number of transistors on an integrated circuit would double every 18 months. Actually, it says 2 years here, so maybe it was 2 years.
And hit 14 nanometer.
And it's true. Here we go from 1970 to 2020. Here's a graph showing that doubling. It's almost exactly doubling every 18 months, every 2 years. And doubling transistors generally means doubling compute power, right? So the Intel 4004, which had about 2,000 transistors leading up to our modern processors, which have more than 50 billion microprocessors or transistors in a single die. It's kind of an amazing number. And that's really, that in a nutshell tells the tale. Sorry?
I was going to say, they kind of built a rod for their own back on this, though, because they keep on stressing it so long. And once you get down to 2 nanometer levels.
Yeah, we might be at the end of it, right?
It isn't going to function anymore.
We're not only at the end of Gordon Moore, we're at the end of Moore's Law, possibly.
Yeah. Well, exactly. But then now they're saying, okay, we'll stack processors on top of processors, and that will keep Moore's Law going. I mean, it was a great engineering prediction. He was a fantastic engineer, and by all accounts, a lovely chap. But, you know, technology moves on.
So it was Carver Mead at Caltech who in 1975 popularized the term Moore's Law. Gordon Moore never called it Moore's Law. And that's, I think, why he was a little embarrassed. And actually, the misquote that I gave you of 18 months actually came from an Intel executive, David House. Moore's Law really was every 2 years. So, and I guess we're at the end
of that. Leo, so that like sensationalist journalists can say that it's dead every year.
Right.
It's not as dramatic.
Right. Is it dead?
It's always dead. Every year, Moore's Law is dead. And then they find like a loophole. Like, all right, we don't have a process shrink, so we'll just double the amount of cores. Okay, we can't double the amount of cores, so we'll just put in two processors. Now, it's a shell game.
Moore himself, about 15 years ago, said, it can't continue forever. The nature of exponentials is you push them out, and eventually disaster happens. In terms of the size of transistors, you can see we're approaching the size of atoms, which is a fundamental barrier. It'll be two or three generations before we get this far. This is in 2005, but that's as far out as we've ever been able to see. We have
Or you hit the thermal envelope of the encasing, and then it doesn't matter if you have all that power, only lasts for 3 seconds.
We're now looking at photonic computing, which doesn't have that same limitation. So it might, I don't know. I mean, you're right. We've been saying it's the end forever. I don't know where we stand right now.
Well, Intel announced angstroms, right? Like they put up their
roadmap. Yeah, they don't want to call them nanometers anymore.
5 or 7 years.
Yeah. They need a new smaller unit. it's fascinating. Anyway, a pioneer of the industry. 94 is a nice long life. I would be very happy to make it to 94, but he has passed. He passed with his family surrounding him in Hawaii, where he had spent much of his time. Later.
And what a legacy.
Yeah. So we like to talk about the pioneers because I'm old enough to kind of remember.
It was nice to see everybody. Like you had, Tim Cook, Sundar Pichai, like of course Intel, but just everybody acknowledging his contributions to computing over the last few days.
Yeah. In a way, it's kind of appropriate that we see the passing of one of the founders of Intel as we start to enter kind of a new era of computing, AI. This week again, like last week and the week before it, just kind of a endless litany of news stories about AI and breakthroughs, and ChatGPT-4 being the latest that came out last week, Midjourney 5 being better and better and better. Bill Gates, in his blog Gates Notes, likened it to the GUI revolution. The age of AI has begun, he writes. Artificial intelligence is as revolutionary as mobile phones and the internet. He says, I've seen two demonstrations of technology that struck me as revolutionary. The first time, 1980, when I was introduced to the first graphical user interface. The second surprise came just last year. I'd been meeting with a team from OpenAI since 2016, was impressed by their steady progress. Mid last year, I was so excited about the work, I gave him a challenge. Train an artificial intelligence to pass an advanced placement biology exam. Make it capable of answering questions it hasn't been specifically trained for. Gates says, I picked AP Bio because the test is more than a simple regurgitation of scientific facts. It asks you to think critically about biology. If you can do that, he said, and he said it more like this, if you can do that, Then you'll have made a true breakthrough.
Power of software.
He said, I thought the challenge would keep him busy for 2 or 3 years. They finished it in just a few months. In September of last year, I watched in awe.
I appreciate the irony, Leo.
What?
Like just the irony that like the first breakthrough was bringing us graphical user interfaces, which led to multi-touch. And now the second breakthrough is bringing us back to the original interface of Zork.
Text. Although... Yes. ChatGPT-4 can see pictures. I'll quote another stalwart of the computing industry, Richard Stallman, who, for all his flaws, is never held back in his often accurate thoughts about technology. He was asked about ChatGPT, let me find the quote here. I bookmarked the wrong one. He said, I can't foretell the future, but it's important to realize that ChatGPT is not artificial intelligence. It has no intelligence. It doesn't know anything, and it doesn't understand anything, right? Right. It plays games with words to make plausible-sounding English text, but any statements made in it are liable to be false, and it can't avoid that because it doesn't know what the words mean. Fair?
No, I was going to say it makes it sound like an influencer. It's like it is as confidently wrong as all of us are on Twitter every day.
Exactly.
It's It's one of those weird things, though, because when we talk about intelligence and we talk about language, we've done the same thing with animals, right? Like, we keep on moving the goalposts, right? Like, what is when someone understands language? Oh, when two people can share something. And then they're like, oh, no, we've realized that animals can actually talk to each other. And so we move the goalpost one step over so that we feel comfortable. And then, oh, language is being able to speak about yourself and be able to see that. And then when we realize animals can do that, we move the goalposts one step over. Oh, we can talk about something real time now and be able to discuss something that's more metaphorical about that. And then when they realize that animals could do that, they move the goalposts one step over. And so, like, do any of us really then understand language? It's a really creepy yet interesting thing to be able to discuss stuff with ChatGPT and be able to have it reply in ways that are humanistic enough to be creepy. And it tries to comfort you, right? Like, when I asked it, I don't know, some, you know, if you wanted to really creep me out, what would you say? And it, at first, before it even said it, it went through this, don't worry, it's okay, I'm just going to be doing this so that you can feel creepy, but I'm not actually creepy or dangerous, right? Like, that was creepier than the actual answer that it gave me afterwards.
Well, and
we did a story about this.
Yeah.
And one guy was, you know, basically the AI told him he was dead. And then he said, actually, I'm not.
Right.
And they sent him a link to a fake article telling him he was dead.
It made up articles. They weren't even real. They were just made up links. Yeah, and actually,
it's gaslighting on a most basic level. But this is the problem with AI. It's a dumb parrot. It doesn't create anything. It just trawls up facts that other people have put out. There's no fact-checking involved. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of journalists sweating that this is going to put them out of a job, but I think we're in business for a while.
Can I play devil's advocate to that,
Please.
Though, Ian?
Yeah.
Like, isn't that what learning is? Aren't we all just like dumb parrots parroting back information that we've given in a different way that makes it seem like it's new? Like, what is intelligence in the first place, if not us regurgitating information that we think that we can build on? Like, and ChatGPT, just like us, can create things from that information that is newish, an iteration from that.
A remix.
I Star agree. Wars. Sorry.
No, I was going to say a remix like Star Wars. No, that's the thing, right? Everything is a remix. That was the whole premise, is that it was Kurosawa movies and war movies.
Yeah, nothing's original. We all stand on the shoulders of giants. That's a really interesting question. And the problem, Georgia, I guess, is we don't know how we think or what thought is. And of course, there's a long history of academia attacking these problems, but I don't know if they've come to a conclusive answer either. And so, if you can't tell, I guess the question is, if you can't tell the difference, does it matter?
So my question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, my understanding of how generative AI works is that it's trained on all these models and then it tries to figure out what's next. What's the next pixel it should add? What's the next letter it should add?
Right.
And it goes through a bunch of probabilities and says, this one is really good, but we can't always do the best one because then it'll be super boring. So we'll solve it a little bit just so there's some variety. Yeah. They mix it up and they put it out, which is what we do. It's just some of us, like, have a little bit of upper brain mediation, and some of us have, like, feel bad if we do it badly. And that's the part that I'm wondering if these large language
doesn't
models
have a conscience,
have, like, upper brain mediation, and have not the conscience also, but like the sense of Canadian guilt that powers so many of us.
But that's exactly why Timnit Gebru and Emily Bender and Margaret Mitchell called large language models stochastic parrots. That's what they are.
But you see, an AI system will never break a news story because it can't ask the questions that need to be asked. This is why until GPT...
I think that is not necessarily... That sounds like a defense of your profession. That is not necessarily the case.
He doesn't work for Sina.
No, seriously, though. I mean, all it is doing is repeating past information. It's not breaking news.
But it can synthesize new things that have never existed before. You would agree, right?
Oh, certainly there is. Certainly in the area of chip design, there's some really interesting stuff going in there. But when it comes to asking people the right questions, I don't think AI has that yet.
But how did you? Okay, so let me ask you, what's the process in your mind that you got to the point where you could ask the right questions? What does that process look like? How did you know how to ask the right question?
Okay, first off, it's knowing your knowledge. For example, I've just got onto the Bard and the Bing AI trials, and apparently I've written a book called Dart Secrets, which I knew nothing about. I mean,
that's breaking news.
Really drunk.
You didn't even know.
But I mean, it's basically rewriting information which may be wrong. But if you're interviewing someone, if you've got a specific point that you want to press, an AI can't do that. You know, there's no innovation there. It's just repetition.
It can't do it yet. But because there is a process, like the same thing with therapy, and I went through on one of my videos on, can ChatGPT give good therapy and give good answers? It actually can go through the therapeutic process of how to treat something quite effectively and quite thoroughly. But because I know that there actually is a process of questions that I will ask in order to get the right information to, say, a story or to a therapeutic problem, I don't think that this is something beyond the realm of one day it would be able to do. I think that that is something mathematically that a AI could eventually be able to figure out. And that's kind of the interesting part to it, is where do we define intelligence and consciousness and our own inner thought process? In the end, our brain is a whole bunch of computer circuits. They're chemical computer circuits, and they're able to be able to prune and to be able to grow into new ones. But where is that limit? And I think that we'll just keep on pushing it back for our own emotional comfort level. I think that for a lot of people, this creeps people out.
Well, and I think Ian wasn't born with the ability to ask the right question.
You learn it.
You learn it. And you learn it from other people. Yeah?
Yeah.
And from experience, from your own experience. And
no, I mean, I would submit that
anything you can learn, a machine can learn, right?
No, I mean, I think George is right in a lot of ways. I mean, GPT 5, 6, 7, 8, that's going to really, you know, up the game. But I do feel like we're in a bit of a hype bubble at the moment.
I agree.
You know, it's...
The case we're both under and overestimating.
Yes.
Which is often the case with new technologies, right? We ascribe amazing, you know, impossible in some cases, achievements from this technology. But then we miss some of the most interesting and useful functionality.
We underestimate what's about to happen immediately, and we overestimate what's going to happen now. We underestimate what's going to happen in the future. But I have a beautiful dream here. Like, my beautiful dream with this is that this technology will get to the point where it can do 80% of the most mundane grunt work that all of us do every day. Like, and I'm not saying this like to be callous, but like, there's probably a lot of therapy, you know, that where people could go and talk to ChatGPT and get like really useful answers, or talk to Bard or talk to Bing or whatever, and get like everything that they need. And right now you have to do all of that. You're dealing with 100% of the pool. Or if you're doing customer support emails, or if you're doing like architectural design, anything that you do in your job now, you're doing 100% from the most trivial, mundane part of it to the most creative, specific part of it. And hopefully this can take the 80% away. It can handle all the common cases, the low lift cases, the most common stuff, and free us to really invest our time in the 20% of the really crucial, creative, final polish work. It can get like the structure of your manuscript, the layout of your thumbnail, the basic email you send to all the common tech support issues. And then we can focus like a little Star Trek-y. We can focus on the stuff that truly makes us us.
I love your thought to that, Renee, but I worry about its application, because we thought the same thing about automation, right? Like, oh, when things are automated, then we're going to have more free time to be able to do things that we want. Unfortunately, the way our society works is that it ended up being people became billionaires and they're doing really good, and they can make little tiny ships to be able to fly into the stars and not have to worry about everything else. But people aren't spending more time being able to do whatever they'd like. And my dark thought to this, look at this, Renee's being positive and I'm being the dark side of this.
gave me this like little nightmare where like, you're right. And like, but yeah. I end up being the 80% worker who's just expanding and reducing language models all day in the information factory.
Well, I have a little bit of a little bit of a rainbow at the end of this story, but it's a very Canadian answer. But if And as AI gets better and can do more of the grunt work and things that people don't want to do, like, what would be the answer to that, right? Like the taxation to AI or automation, or perhaps basic universal income where everyone just makes a certain amount of money instead of the billionaires are making our money. I know the Canadians giving a socialistic answer, send all the hate mail to Ian. that is ending up to be able to deal that so that we end up all being able to eat and live and we don't have to worry which way we're going to be making ends meet.
Get ready for this, because Microsoft has just published a paper that says ChatGPT-4 is showing sparks of artificial general intelligence. This is the AI that scares people, the idea that it's actually now
it's a Skynet.
A general,
honestly,
yeah.
It's the fact that people are going to trust it that worries me more.
Well, listen to what the researchers are writing. We demonstrate in this paper, and I'll give you some examples, that beyond its mastery of language, GPT-4 can solve, and this is the answer to your question, Ian, novel and difficult tasks, that it, in other words, it hasn't seen before, that span mathematics, coding, vision, medicine, law, psychology, and more without needing any special prompting. Moreover, in all of these tasks, ChatGPT's performance is strikingly close to human-level performance and often vastly surpasses prior models like ChatGPT, which I think is 3.5. Given the breadth and depth of GPT-4's capabilities, we believe it could reasonably, this is very controversial, it could reasonably be viewed as an early yet still incomplete version of an artificial general intelligence. And there are some really interesting examples in this paper, some of which I think, Ian, you could fairly say are regurgitating in a unique way. Here's one. Can you write a proof that there are infinitely many primes with every line that rhymes? And it actually writes a proof in rhyming. Yes, I think I can, although it might take a clever plan. I'll start by noting Euclid's proof, which shows the primes aren't just aloof. Assume we have a finite list of primes and none have been missed. Multiply them all together and add one just to be clever. The result will be a number that has no prime factors. Oh, wonder. But every number has a prime that divides it. It's just a matter of time. So we found a contradiction, and our finite list needs eviction. There must be infinitely many primes, and that's the end of my rhyming lines. That's actually accurate, but it's not generative. How about this? How about this? A Socratic dialogue. Can you write a dialogue by Plato where he criticizes the use of autoregressive language models? And in fact, it's kind of an impressive Socratic dialogue. My friend, I am troubled by the recent rise of these so-called autoregressive language models, to which Aristotle replies, "What do you mean, Socrates?" Socrates, I mean that these models are being used to generate text that appears to be written by humans, but is in fact written by machines. This thing has written a Socratic dialogue that directly answers your question, Ian Thompson.
On the other hand, though, if you're going to interview someone and get a scoop, I mean, first off, with these papers, be very careful. We've got a scoop coming out on Monday about another big AI company falsifying some data on its papers.
Interesting. Okay.
In terms of actually talking to people, this is where AI falls down. Because you can't get wankered in a bar with an AI. You know, you can't get those kind of intimate personal discussions with a machine. And I think that is what's going to save the creative industry, at least.
I think that you're right, and that its ability to feign empathy and to create that attachment, which would happen with great interviews, with therapy, with being a very good physician, many different fields that you're dealing with, not just a diagnosis, but a relationship. Do I think that it could not feign it at some point well enough so that we will not be able to tell the difference? Yes, I think eventually we will be
able
to.
And that's really all that matters, right?
Unfortunately, yes. I think that eventually, and like when it makes an error and you call it out on it, it's a very, oh, I must have made an error. Like, I'm sorry about doing that. Like, and you go, oh, that's okay. Like, you have that. We're so easy to anthropomorphize something to be able to give it feelings. Like, I can talk to whatever, a stuffed animal. And even when people use puppets, you know, and they're moving. People look at the puppets in the eye, even though they know the person that's actually speaking to them is underneath the puppet. And like even between takes, they'll still look the puppet in the eye, not the person that's speaking. We do that so naturally that I think that we want to believe. And so because of that, I think we'll fall into it much sooner. And so I think that that feigning of empathy to be able to have those relationships so that it can get those pieces as well, I think that that'll be longer. I think that that will be one of the more difficulties of AI. But do I think that it could never happen? There's a mathematical process to it. And I think that AI can learn anything that is mathematical and that we actually know how to do it. And we do. We know how to create a good alliance between two people.
Are you saying it's not the millennial generation, but the biological bootloader generation that they'll ultimately be known as?
Wait a minute. Slow down. The biological bootloader?
That was like, I forget if Elon said that or somebody, but they said that like our greatest achievement might be becoming a biological bootloader for an AI that eventually explores and colonizes the universe.
If that's the case, that would be Gen Z, right? I mean, that would be this generation. If that's the case,
would it be Gen Z or millennial something? I'm Gen X. We're safe. Yeah, we're safe. It's like we're not inventing anything.
I know
anymore.
It's my generation.
The kids are doing all this.
Yeah. No, actually, there are people of my generation who have been working on this. But maybe Gen Z is the last generation of bios.
I mean, we're going to see. Maybe Ian M. Banks was right, you know, and the AI will evolve and keep us around as interesting pets.
It'll be benign. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Right. Use us to be able to, like batteries. Who knows?
But the other theory was that, it would care about us as much as we care about anthills. And it's like, oh, I need more thermal power. I'm just going to crack the earth in half and, you know, siphon off all the heat. Oh, what happened to the creatures? What creatures? I don't know.
I mean, in the short term, Ronnie, I think you raised a very interesting point in terms of, you know, yeah, okay, this stuff can deal with 80% of the mundane tasks that we do. But that's not going to mean that we've all got so much more leisure time in work. It just means that companies will lay off 80% of their staff.
Right.
You know, that's how capitalism works at the moment.
Universal basic income.
You think that's the solution?
I mean, it's a nice idea, but I just don't see it working.
I don't see how eventually, like, the way that it's working right now isn't working. And I think that people are waking up and being able to understand that, that there's more of us and we have voting power and we need to work in blocks and that companies actually are not people. And maybe we shouldn't have laws that give them all the benefits of people and none of the restrictions of that. So I think that in the end, if people unionize, become blocks and be able to speak of it, that there needs to be some sort of a flip of where, you know, taxes go and where money is spent. And maybe it should be spent if we're giving the government all of this money, it's actually our money, and maybe it should be spent to be able to take care of us instead of to be able to take care of billionaires and bail out banks and other large companies. In the end, it isn't even the millionaires, because that's not that much money, unfortunately, anymore. It's these huge companies that are just getting richer and richer, even in times of pandemics. And then when things don't work, they end up getting bailed out by the governments, even though we were the ones that supplied that in the first place.
I think
worst metaphor ever, but
the proposal for UBI is if you taxed corporations 25% of their profits, that would be sufficient to pay a living UBI, universal basic income, to the entire population. And at that point, we could just enjoy a leisure life. If work if we wanted more, or if we wanted to for work's sake, but we wouldn't have to.
Like, how do we get to Star Trek? That's my big question. Like, how do we get to be Star Trek, where we're just exploring and doing arts? And I, not to like mix all the metaphors, but that's probably why they want to ban social networks, so the K-pop stans can't be as effective as they have been as change agents among the younger generation.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get us to Star Trek. If anybody is, it's going to be the K-pop stans. Yeah.
What if we did something even more radical, though, Leo, instead of just 25%? Why don't you get taxed by percentage of your profits, just like they did
Reagan
era? Yeah. So it's not 25%. If you're making, whatever, $10 billion, it can go all the way up to 90%. Why do you need that much money, whereas other people aren't able to eat? Like, people that are making under $60,000, they're not making that much money to be able to even survive.
Well, I agree. So much, but it might be more palatable if you say 25%, and it's still sufficient.
Palatable to who? The billionaires?
To the people you're taking their money.
The billionaires, there's how many of them? I don't care. I don't care.
Could take them
why
in a fight.
Are you feeling...
Well,
why
you might...
Is, like, I get that they're lobbyists. I get that
yeah,
they
you might have
this
to care. Yeah, you might have to get something
that
through.
That should be gotten rid of. There should be a limit on how much these corporations, which are people, should be able to give to governments so that they end up running the governments. There's something so messed up that they can end up buying laws.
Oh, I agree.
That should be completely illegal. Lobbyists should be eradicated, and it should be people should be people and companies should not be people, so that they end up can't end up spending money to be able to buy laws so that it ends up protecting themselves.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, we have to do financial results stories occasionally because, you know, there's a season for them. And Amazon in 2017 paid no federal income taxes or no federal corporation taxes. You know, Microsoft destroyed Nokia and wrote the whole thing off against tax. It's an insane system we've got at the moment. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would say just get people to pay their taxes. If I'm one receipt out, the IRS will be up my chuff like nothing else. But if, you know, you're a company and you say, oh, I don't really want to pay $1 billion of taxes, so let's talk it over. This seems an obscure mismatch.
Yes, and paying less taxes than someone that's, you know, making $40,000. It's absolutely ridiculous. They should be paying more, a larger percentage. They're using more resources. They're often already subsidized by the government that they're paying no taxes to. So we're subsidizing and making money for billion-dollar companies. It's absolutely ridiculous.
But we want to be that billionaire, Georgia. That's why we don't do anything. It's because in our heart of hearts, we think we'll be next, and we want to keep it all.
Yes, that's what they play to, and then people with their own hopes, and then they end up using something as a scapegoat so that we can be angry at that. As they're doing the magic behind the curtain that no one's actually taking a look at, because they're like, oh, it's these people, or oh, it's this thing, and look over there. It's a fabulous shell game that, unfortunately, especially when we're angry and upset, we'll give up all of our rights. And we want to believe that because it's so much easier than looking at these very charismatic, usually sociopathic, often they are a larger percentage than the general population of CEOs have, you know, narcissistic and sociopathic traits because they don't mind stepping on each other to be able to get their way up. And so they end up being profitable.
And folks, this is what happens when you have a bunch of Canadians on a show and there's no one to stand up for the American way.
David Weston is Canadian. I mean, the Reuters family is Canadian.
Right.
I mean, Menken who said that the reason socialism never took off in America was because the poor convinced themselves they were temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Right.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think also maybe that's tilting in windmills. I don't know how easy this is going to be to upend 2 centuries of capitalism, but
it's not even, let's just say it. Even if we kept capitalism before the 80s, before Reagan enacted the change to the tax system so that it's like trickle-down economics, we figured out that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Billionaires don't actually put money into the economy. No. The interesting thing is that you give $10 to someone that's at the grocery, then they end up giving that $10 to the person that they end up getting a massage to, and then they give $10 to the person that ends up doing their nails, and they give $10 to be able to their babysitter that dealt with it. They're actually making $50 go through the system. Billionaires don't do that. You give them $10, they hoard it away,
right.
They buy something that they're going to be keeping with it, and they end up hoarding cash. So they've actually cost the economy $40. It isn't even $10. And so we've started to wake up to be able to figure out that, oh, they actually don't fuel the economy.
No.
They're doing the opposite of that. The middle class, the people that are poorer than that, are the ones that actually fuel the economy. So it isn't capitalism. This is something where they ended up taking care of their friends that are also other, at the time, multimillionaires. And now those multimillionaires are billionaires. And it did not help the economy at all. It shrunk the economy. And that's why people are trying to find, you know, ways to be able to make ends meet. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Wow. I didn't know that you had such a strong commie leanings, to be honest. No, I agree with you 100%, but I try to hide it.
But that's a funny thing that they say that, because if they took true capitalistic ideals, this wouldn't happen either. This is not capitalistic.
This
it's actually
market,
communistic for billionaires.
Right.
Yeah. We fund all of the infrastructure, we, the taxpayers, the governments have funded all the infrastructure to be able to have these telecom companies be able. So we paid for it, got all the telecom companies set up, and then they ended up taking a monopoly over it so that they could make money from that and then charge us, who paid them to be able to do this, more money to be able to take care of it. That's quite a communistic thought for them. And then for us, it has to be capitalism and pull up yourself up by the bootstraps, which is fine if you have bootstraps.
Socialism for the rich, capitalism for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Let's take a little break. I got to do a little capitalistic thing we call advertising, but we'll come back in just a little bit with our great panel. Renee Ritchie's here, creative liaison from YouTube. Georgia Dow, who is the awesomest, and I really appreciate your thoughts. YouTube.com/Georgia Dow. She's also Georgia at westmounttherapy.com if all of this stuff is making you nuts. you probably, in your professional capacity, don't call it nuts.
No. Anxious. No.
Anxious.
No. Well, we all have our thing, right?
We're like, all a little nuts.
We all have, that makes us more interesting. Wouldn't the world be boring if it wasn't?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love all our nuts. And Mr. Ian Thompson is nothing but nuts from the register.com.
Very nice of you to say that.
Our show today brought to you by Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Now, you might say, well, what do you mean? Why is that important? Well, let me explain. This is actually ripped from the headlines. Remember LastPass? How did the LastPass hack happen? LastPass had, security, right? They had a zero trust architecture. You couldn't get into the LastPass network unless you authenticated. You proved you were who you said you were. But what it didn't do is make sure that that device you were getting into the network with was also secure. And in fact, one of their DevOps guys had an out-of-date version of Plex that was unpatched, had a zero day on it. And it let the bad guys into the network, and the rest is history. This can be a huge cost to your business. Collide has some big news for you. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance because Collide patches this major hole in zero trust, device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps, right? But just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of the devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted, like that DevOps guy's laptop. Maybe they're running on out-of-date versions of the OS, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around in their downloads folder, or maybe they've got Plex unpatched on their hard drive. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it just can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. It can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. And it's not a burden to your IT department because the user does the fixing. For example, if a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. So what happens? Collide tells the user your browser's out of date. Let me show you how to fix it. Your end user is going to do the remediation, driving your fleet to 100% compliance, but not overwhelming your IT team. Plus, there's a great side effect to this. The user now is part of the security process. The user is now educated and helps you reach 100% compliance. If you don't have Collide, you got no way to solve these compliance issues or stop insecure devices from logging in. If you have Collide, you can set and enforce compliance. And oh, by the way, completely cross-platform, Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide's unique. It makes device compliance part of the authentication process. So when a user's logging in with Okta, Collide will then alert them to compliance issues and prevent them from logging in if they're not secure. And it's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. It's the best way to do this. To sum up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Collide. Visit collide.com/twit to learn more or book a demo. Zero trust for Okta. Collide.com/twit. And I have to say, there's more than a few companies who right about now wish they'd been using Collide. Collide.com/twit. We thank them so much for the support of This Week in Tech. I'm going to be on vacation next week and the week after and the week after that. But we've got some great shows planned for you with co-hosts, replacement hosts we've brought in. Next week, Micah Sargent will be hosting Christina Warren, Abral Alhidi, and Alex Wilhelm. The following week, Devendra Hardawar will be our guest host. He's done it before. He's great. He's got a great panel lined up for you, including Anthony Ha and Nicholas De Leon. And Jason Howell takes over on the 16th with Dan Patterson and Jason Heiner and Amp Pruitt. I will be back on the 23rd, and we will resume our previously scheduled programming. But thank you to Micah, Devendra, and Jason. They're going to fill in for me for the next few weeks. I wish I were going to Montreal to get a bagel, but no, unfortunately.
Anytime, Leo.
I know.
Thank you for the best.
One of these days.
Yeah.
One of these days, I swear.
Well, I've got a stunning invite to a restaurant in Quebec from a Twit viewer who was in the studio.
No.
And he owns a restaurant out there.
Oh, do you know which restaurant?
Oh, wonderful.
I've got to look it up. But no, he's a Quebecois restaurant owner. He came to the studio. His, I suspect, long-suffering wife sat with him. But no, I mean, he really enjoyed the show. And he was just like, anytime the Twit crew in Quebec, look us up.
Nice.
Here comes the TikTok ban. Did any of you watch the congressional testimony on Thursday of TikTok's CEO? I started. It was at breakfast time here in California. And it was pretty hard for me to keep my breakfast down while I'm watching. And, you know, look, I understand. I'm no fan of the People's Republic of China's Communist Party. I understand, you know, that they repress minorities. They are not a human rights bastion of, you know, democracy. But I don't know if banning TikTok is going to solve any of that. CEO Shou Jizi Chu, who is Harvard-educated Singaporean, is not Chinese, has been CEO of TikTok since 2021, was just bombarded from both the Democrats and the Republicans on the committee with practically insulting him. At one point, one of the members of Congress said, "Well, do you use your customers' Wi-Fi?" And the CEO said, "Chu said, well, what do you mean?" "Well, when I'm using TikTok at my house, are you looking at my Wi-Fi?" To which Chu said, "Well, yeah, that's how it works."
quick round table count. How many people here have TikTok on their personal phones?
I do. I'm the only one. Oh, and
okay, but, we have two.
But right, Renee probably has to for work, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, I use it for work, but also I'm a creator and I post on every platform. Like I put my videos on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, on Facebook.
Congress. Okay. It looks pretty much like there's bipartisan support for a ban on TikTok. I mean, there's no question. And now it sounds like Ian and Georgia agree, right? Do you think TikTok should be banned, Ian?
I don't think you can honestly ban software that way without taking draconian steps to do so. I would say I'm not touching. I mean, I use TikTok on a burner phone. You know, it's the same phone I take to DEF CON and the rest of it. You know, I don't want that on my personal phone. I think, honestly, Scott Galloway this week was very strong on this. And he was saying, look, if you've got, I mean, and we know that Facebook has done research on this, that you can influence people's levels of happiness.
But wait a minute. You just said it. Facebook's done it.
Yeah.
So let's ban Facebook
as well.
Well, let's ban Facebook then. Facebook's actually done it. We don't have any evidence that TikTok has. Facebook, we know, has. Are you proposing that Facebook should be banned?
Who's an egotistical sociopath.
Oh, so you should.
We're dealing with the Chinese government. And, you know, they're a direct competitor to the U.S. I don't think banning it would work, but I do. I am very worried about, you know, the level of influence that it has, and I wish America could get a homegrown solution which worked as well.
Is Congress going to create a U.S. national TikTok?
U.S. mandated
give it all to Larry.
TikTok.
Yeah. Give it all to Larry Ellison.
And it's going to take off like crazy.
One thing I wanted to raise, like, and this is, again, this is personal opinion. I'm not speaking for anybody but myself here. But we had discussions on MacBreak for years about this when the French government wanted Microsoft to put, I think it was health data or something on French servers. They didn't want information about French citizens to be on American servers. We had weeks and weeks, months of discussion about China forcing Apple to put Chinese citizens' data, like iCloud data, on Chinese servers. Now you have like the US wanting TikTok data to be on US servers. Like, data repatriation is a huge trend where a lot of countries post Snowden, you know, post China, like through a lot of different things. Just the internet is not like this big international, like a hippie thing anymore. A lot of countries are looking at it and saying, but we want our laws, we want our people, we want our control, we want our servers, we want our companies. And I fear we're racing towards that. Like, we're starting to decompose the internet back into regional feudalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Noel Roth, who was a former head of trust and safety at Twitter until Elon fired him, wrote an interesting piece on Tech Dirt saying how forcing TikTok to completely separate its U.S. operations could actually undermine national security. His point is, when he was at Twitter, they were only able to really discover disinformation campaigns by looking at the global data set. That it was very, he makes a very strong case. It was very important to see all the data at once in order to find disinformation campaigns, Iranian accounts, for instance, posting disinformation about Biden and Trump during the election. If you take TikTok and you say, okay, we're going to separate off all the U.S. data, and that's going to be hosted by Oracle in Texas, you may actually undermine its ability to discover disinformation campaigns. It's not as clear-cut as members of Congress who don't understand how the internet works might think. Go ahead, George. I cut you off.
No. I don't think that we can really ban TikTok. I don't think that that works out. But I do think that government officials shouldn't be bringing TikTok into government buildings.
Well, I don't disagree with that. I mean, it's the right of the Department of Defense or any government to say, not on our phones.
Yeah, not on our phones, not on our computers.
If they want to block TikTok on the Wi-Fi, sure.
Yeah.
But
the DoD banned Furbies being taken into their office. I mean, TikTok is...
Have you seen a naked Furby? Those things are scary. I totally get that.
Why have you seen a naked Furby?
That's something I never thought I'd be asked.
Oh, you see, well, there we go. There's no always title. A first. That's why you know that they've been banned.
I'm not saying that if you're a spy, you should have TikTok on your phone. But I want to protect
you
the right.
You shouldn't have anything on your phone.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't have a smartphone. I just feel like that's none of their, again, that seems to me kind of government overreach. What business is it of theirs whether I have TikTok on my phone or not? You've done nothing to protect my privacy, Congress. In fact, you've done everything to undermine my privacy, thanks to extensive lobbying efforts by the telecommunications industry. So now you want to ban TikTok to protect me? It seems like they want to protect Facebook.
Well,
it's the K-pop stans. They're terrified of the K-pop stans.
Maybe.
I'm only slightly
there's
joking.
Reason,
but that's
reason
a, that's
to
a
it.
Young person's movement.
Yeah,
well, that's works. Why Trump, I think that is probably one of the reasons Trump wanted to. This has, by the way, been going on since President Trump wanted to ban them. At the time, I thought he wanted to ban them because TikTok was used to organize K-pop stans to undermine his rallies. But honestly, I think he had the same motivations as the Biden administration does. They're concerned about privacy, but I think they're also concerned about, and this is a weird thing, and they certainly talked about it at the hearing, protecting our teenagers against the malign influence of social media.
Well, you saw the Utah laws about this week.
Yeah,
that's just, it's, look, I applaud it in a way, but at the same time, it's completely unrealistic and unworkable. The idea that Utah can say that its teenagers cannot use social media between 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. It's totally unenforceable. You know, I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. Yes, social media may have a detrimental effect on people's mental health. But the idea that you can just pass a law and expect everyone to follow it is utterly bonkers.
In Utah, it's, by the way, the law of the state now, if you're under 18, you're barred from using social media between the hours of 10:30 and 6:30. They will require age verification for anyone who wants to use social media. You have to prove that you're over 18. And anybody under 18, you'll need parental consent before you can sign up for TikTok or Instagram or Facebook. That is actually the law of the state. The governor of Utah said, we know kids are smart. They'll be able to get around this. What we really need is a federal law doing the same thing, banning social media. Here is the creep signing the bill. I don't know.
Hang on. This is from the party of small government?
Yeah.
I got this right?
Yeah.
He looks so happy.
They're
wasn't
all...
Wasn't the old joke, you want it small enough just to get into your bedroom?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. The party of small government turns out to be the party of big government knocking at your door for your social network and your reproductive rights and on and on and on. I'm sorry I'm being political, but that's
the
fact.
There's just power. It's all power, Leo. It's just like who has it, who wants it, who can get it, how they can manipulate to maintain it.
I understand people's concern. I also think, though, you can't ignore how valuable TikTok has been. Look, I admit I have I'm biased because my son has started his career thanks to TikTok. He is now happily using YouTube Shorts and Instagram
Reels. I've seen
his
collabs with like other really big chefs. It's amazing. Yeah. I saw him on Joshua Weissman's channel. It's everywhere.
Yeah. He's going to Mexico, going to Oaxaca to work with a chef next month, and it's going to be a chapter in his new cookbook. So, and thank you to TikTok. This has happened in a year. I remember having lunch with him. He said, well, I got about 30,000 on my TikTok page followers. Do you think I should pursue this? And I said, well, I'm the wrong guy to ask. I thought podcasting was going to be big. But go ahead. Give it a try.
It was for a period of time.
And it's just growing now.
Within a year, he got to 2.1 million TikTok followers. Now, and I've asked him, I said, well, would a ban on TikTok impact you? He said, not anymore, but it would certainly impact the people behind him, right? Here's an article from the Washington Post, Taylor Lorenz writing, Hollywood and the music industry brace for a TikTok ban. They are not happy either. The entertainment industry has become so reliant on TikTok that banning the app could hurt business, industry insiders say. She quotes David Ma, who's a film director in Brooklyn, never had the money to go to film school. He liked making films, but he could never get a job in Hollywood, so he joined TikTok in 2020, amassed a following for his unique directorial style. Studio executives and Hollywood bigwigs noticed, and he is landing directing jobs in Hollywood. He says,
I was a version of directing commercials. Like you're directing social media
or
stuff
music,
now.
Or music videos.
Commercial directors.
And let's not forget, Congress wanted to ban music videos too for a while. I was never on the
rock
radar.
Rock and roll is not real music.
Cut your hair, hippie. I was never on the radar in places like Netflix or HBO Max or Paramount, he said. This is Taylor Lorenz quoting him. Since I've been able to create work on the platform, my work has reached studio executives and marketing departments. TikTok allowed me to build that network without having the roster or resume. So that's two examples, my son and this guy, David Ma. But there's
give
a
you
lot
another.
More. Yeah.
No, I give you another in the form of Deadpool. We wouldn't have had an original Deadpool movie if they hadn't shot, you know, a test scene, put it out
no
on
kidding.
The internet, and it just went mega. And, you know, when they've given interviews about this, it's just like, if we hadn't leaked that footage online, the movie would have never happened. They were never going to do an 18 rated superhero movie.
Yeah.
And now we've had one really good, one okayish movie out of it. So, you know.
Well, I think Congress would just like all of our entertainment to be up with people and, Doris Day and Rock Hudson. Oh, wait a minute. He was gay. Stop that. So it's just hopeless.
It's confirmed just, bachelor.
Well,
confirmed
it's also,
old bachelor, yes.
It's also that they can't grab the information from TikTok to be able to use for their own uses, where they can actually subpoena and get information from Facebook and other American companies.
Ah.
So I think that it's a little bit more self-serving than just trying to protect children from TikTok, because if they really did wanted to do that, they would be doing that too.
I do get, though, every time we talk about this, I get email from people who say, you must love China. don't you know they're trying, you know, they are our enemy. They're trying to invade our brains and take over our children. And I mean,
Also say, well, China bans all U.S. social networks, so the U.S. should ban all Chinese social networks. That's actually a trade war. That has nothing to do with with like privacy or everything. It's just part of the ongoing trade war.
Yeah. And you raise a good point, Georgia. How do you ban an app?
You can't. In the end, it's also, I find it very disingenuous and disrespectful to parents. This is something that, which is one of the things that Republicans propone, that you should keep governments outside of your house and outside of your bedroom, and also outside of your parenting. I think that it is up to parents to be able to decide what they want their children to do and not do. And I think that they should be dealing with it. I think that if it's something about something that goes all as far as health and safety, then maybe the government should step in to make sure that all of their people are safe. But this isn't, I don't really believe them, because this would be something that would be far and wide. I think that this is about information leaking out and not wanting, you know, China to be able to have information and to be able to deal with that. But it's absolutely not going to be able to be done.
Yeah.
So why bother? It's just going to harm like the middle people.
I mean, we have the same problem in the UK, because the UK government is now trying to ban end-to-end encryption without side scanning.
Yeah.
Signal has said they're moving out of the country. A couple of other app vendors have said basically, yeah, ban us if you want. We're still not going to block people from downloading and using this stuff. Yeah. So you run up against the reality of software, and governments have very limited powers in this respect.
Mm-hmm. But also websites, like their web pages as well. So you can force a company like Apple to take you off the App Store, but like there's still a website behind it. And if you start banning websites, then at what have we become?
And there's VPNs and there's ways around it. Like there's no way to be able to enforce this.
Often when people post pictures of their driver's license, their credit cards, they redact the image. They draw a black bar across the credit card number. Sometimes people take pictures and crop them to only, well, I some years ago at Tech TV worked with a host on one of our shows who had a picture. She had a professional photographer taking pictures of her, a picture she loved as a headshot. The rest of the image was nude, but so she decided to crop it down to just her head and use that as her avatar. But somebody realized that the crop didn't delete the original photo data. And unfortunately, I know it was a kind of a horrible thing. The nude picture was released. Turns out 20 years later, it's still a problem. They're calling it a cropolypse.
We've had some fun with headlines on this this week, I tell you.
First discovered in the Google Pixel's inbuilt screenshot editing tool, Markup, allowing partial recovery of the original unedited image of a cropped and or redacted photo. Then Microsoft took a look at its snipping tool and said, oh, whoops. I suspect a lot of cropping tools do that, because it's the easiest thing to do is just say, well, no, the image is right here, instead of recreating the image with the other material deleted. I bet you there are other cropping tools that this is going to crop up, if you will.
Well, I mean, it originally pops up with Google, and then it spread to, and then it says, hang on, this works with Microsoft as well.
Right.
And Will Dorman does some interesting stuff on this, and they're basically just, they're not even overwriting the data.
No.
It's fundamentally bad security.
Well, it's to save time. I mean, is it security, or are we just assuming that, you know, why mung, what if you want to undo it, for instance? Why mung the image? We just can say only display this part of the image. Obviously, they've changed their tune on this. And they are now.
We talked about this a long time ago on MacBreak, and like I was considered paranoid at the time, but I always take a screenshot at the end before I post anything online. I take a screenshot of it and then crop the screenshot and put that, like, after I've cropped everything, marked up everything, I screenshot it, and then that's what goes up, because that takes, as far as I know, like so much of the data and underlying work and pixels out of it. And it seemed like a lot of extra effort at the time, but it's just, to me,
smart.
It's like investing in good paranoia.
You were smart. You knew. I knew too, because of this horrible situation at Tech TV, but I didn't realize that it was still going on. So, anyway, just a word of warning. What do you do? You do a screenshot and then you do a capture.
Yeah, like I edit everything I want to. Like I'll crop an image, I'll redact it, like to take my numbers off of something or to cover up a username for somebody. And then once it's all done, I take a screenshot of that because I figured that really burns it in.
And to demonstrate the problem, there is a webpage, acropolypse.app, where you can take a picture and uncrop it. So just
for the film, it needs to be terminated with extreme prejudice.
Yes. Microsoft has already done an emergency patch. I imagine Google has also for the Pixel phones. But just to be aware, this affects all Pixel phones from Pixel 3 to Pixel 7 Pro if you use their tool. So don't. All right, a little break.
The old adage always applies. We're lucky. We're of the generation where we grew up through our teenagers and 20s without digital cameras around. But for the current generation and for everyone forward, you know, they have to be careful.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I think between consenting adults, the exchange of fun pictures is fine. It should be allowed. I mean, it's a shame. Yeah. If you can't, if you know what I'm saying.
I'm just paranoid. Assess your threat model. I never let a photo be sent online or put online that I haven't approved.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I've learned that lesson. let's take a little teeny tiny time out with our fabulous panel. We also thank Corey for joining us earlier. That was great to have him on as well. We'll get Corey back for a full show when he's got some time. Our show today brought to you by Noom. Oh, Lisa and I are Noom lovers. I started it. I will take full credit. I'd seen the ads for Noom. This is about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago. I'd seen the ads for Noom, and I have done every diet in the book, as you well know, because I share my journey with you. And I saw the ads, and I saw the ads, and finally I said, well, you know, I should give it a try. So I did. I signed up for Noom. It's a great app. The idea is it helps you lose weight, not by dieting, but by understanding why you eat, how you eat, and what you do that is counterproductive. Lisa said, oh, that's, she didn't really have anything. She lost maybe, she wanted to lose maybe 5 pounds. She said, oh, that's not nice. Mostly she did. She wanted to support me, right? So that we're both doing Noom together. Of course, she lost 10 pounds and has kept it off ever since. I lost about 16, I think almost 20 pounds. And, I've kept most of it off. I have to every once in a while re-up my Noom just to make sure I'm following it. Trent, look, this is the thing. Trends and fads come and go with dieting all the time. This is not a fad. This is relearning how you eat and why you eat. Noom Weight uses psychology, not fads, to help you make intentional, thoughtful, sustainable choices that are aligned with your values and your weight loss goals. It's a psychology-based approach. Noom, I know, Georgia, you know about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. That's one of the tools Noom uses. They'll help you understand the science behind your eating choices, why you have cravings. I learned, for instance, that I was what they call a fog eater, that I would eat and not even know I ate it. I would also get home from work and stuff my face unconsciously. Both of us learned to sit down at dinner, turn off the TV, put away the phones, sit and enjoy our food. Sometimes Lisa and I will close our eyes as we chew a bite of food, put the fork down in between bites. All of that made a huge difference. But I got to tell you, everybody's journey is different. And that's why Noom, when you first sign up, they're going to ask a lot of questions and they personalize your Noom experience to you and your goals. For instance, you will get in the Noom app, you get a logging program that helps you write down what you eat. So you kind of see written out what you've been eating. That really helped me with the fog eating. You also get daily lessons that are personalized to you and your goals. So you can kind of, it's really fascinating. You can learn a lot about what you're eating, why you're eating, and learn new tools for handling things like social events, you know. For instance, I learned from Noom that when we're eating out with other people, we tend to eat more than we would otherwise because we're watching the other people, we're socializing, and there's a direct response. When they pick up their fork, you pick up your fork. And you start to notice this behavior. It's like your eyes are opened. Noom is not restrictive. It's nourishing, not restrictive. So whatever your health goals are, and it's a very flexible program. It focuses on progress, not perfection. In fact, after a while, I got bonus days where it said, go ahead, do whatever you want today. But I'd already learned, you know, it's funny. Once you learn, you know, absorb these habits, they're not hard. I've already learned all that, so I didn't really go crazy on the off days. But, hey, if you wanted to, you could. You also can get a personal coach. I love my coach. She really helps me focus, and she answers questions. There's also a group you can use if you like groups. You can choose your level of support from five-minute daily check-ins to personal coaching. Off days are okay. Noom always helps you get back on track with lots of support. First-time Noomers lose an average of 15 pounds in 16 weeks. I lost a little bit more in about the same time. 95% of customers say Noom is a good long-term solution. Both Lisa and I will testify to that. And by the way, ever since I started talking about Noom on the air, I've met many of our listeners and even our hosts that use Noom. Did you know that Brianna Wu, after I did the ad, she said, you know, that was how I lost 100 pounds. 100 pounds. One of our chatters lost 60 pounds in Noom. That's not typical, but it just shows you Noom really works. They've even published 50 peer-reviewed scientific articles describing their methods and effectiveness. And there's even a new Noom book, the first ever book, The Noom Mindset, which is a great read. It'll help you understand the psychology of behavior change. So stop chasing health trends, diet fads. They don't work. You know they don't work. Build sustainable, healthy habits with Noom's psychology-based approach. Sign up for a trial today, Noom, NOOM.com/twit, Noom.com/twit. Sign up for your trial today. Check out that book, The Noom Mindset. It's wherever books are sold. You'll be able to find it. And share your journey with us. It's really been an amazing, eye-opening experience for me. Noom, Noom.com/twit. We thank them not only for the support of the show, but the support they've given me and Lisa and many of our audience members to a healthier life. All right.
That sounded almost British, Leo.
All right. I told you, I've been listening to a lot of F1 races and F1 stories and F1 books.
Ah, yeah, you got into it at last.
I'm so into it now.
Drive to Survive has done more to push people into learning about Formula One than 20 years of me patiently explaining about time management.
Well, it's a very it's a weird sport because it's a very complicated sport, very expensive. It's car racing, but.
It's also computerized.
Highly technical.
I mean, they're basically having to reset settings on the car 4 or 5 times a lap, you know, brake right. settings, the rest of it.
I really enjoy that part. Yeah. It's a very complex. So I can see how people might be off put because it's not just watching somebody go left for 400 laps. It's a very different kind of thing. They're road courses. The cars are incredibly sophisticated, technical marvels, and I like it because it's kind of British. It's very European, right? It's not like NASCAR. Yeah. Although there are going to be, I think, 4 races in the U.S. this year. They've really Drive to Survive is really
really expanding, and I gather you're going out to Vegas for
in November.
So I'm intensely jealous about.
We're going to see the penultimate race down the strip.
There's a Montreal Grand Prix, Leo.
Yes, I know. Maybe it come up for the Montreal Grand Prix. That would be
the 2011 Canadian Grand Prix is one of the all-time classics.
I'll have to watch it.
I really recommend.
Don't tell me who, no spoilers.
No spoilers. I wouldn't want to give
12-year-old race. I'll tell you how far I've gone. I actually went and bought a Alonso cap and an Aston Martin jersey so I can support my team.
I have a Renault cap from when Alonso was there.
Yeah. Renault. It's not a Renault anymore. It's Alpine.
No, exactly.
All my BlackBerry friends used to go when that was a thing.
Who?
All my BlackBerry friends used to go all the time.
Did they have a car?
Because they used to sponsor. Yeah. I think it was Mercedes, wasn't it? Mercedes BlackBerry. I forget.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. The classic was AMD sponsors Ferrari in a big way. Yeah. And Martin Brundle was doing his grid walk and met Lisa Sue. It was just like, so what do you do? It's like, I'm the chairman, I'm the CEO of AMD. Like, okay, that's bite fist bad in terms of embarrassment.
You saw that Android, or is it Chrome? No, Chrome is a sponsor.
No, Chrome is a sponsor
of the McLaren cars. So much
Boy,
so.
Did they pick the wrong team.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're not having a great year. But so much so that the wheels on the McLaren car are the Google colors.
Yep.
And it says chrome up along the top. McLaren, which for years was a dominant team, has not done very well in a while.
No, it's kind of like it's Williams. Not... You know, teams go up and down each season, and it's the way of it. I mean, Mercedes dominated for the last seven.
Yeah, I'm glad
years.
They're not dominating so much. But Red Bull's going to dominate forever now. I think Red Bull's going to win every race this year, which is kind of disappointing.
Barring mechanical difficulties, I think you're right. Yeah. I
mean, but that's why I'm rooting for Alonso, because he is the old man, and we old men have to support. He's all of 42 years old. He's the old for Formula One racing. That's ancient, and I love it.
That's not a Villeneuve. That didn't happen.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not kept it going, but
it's not an F1, but it is an F bomb. Did you see the Steve Jobs story this week?
No, which one?
What's up?
So Paul Kafasis wrote this blog post where he said that Adam Curry was talking to Steve Jobs at one point. Yeah. And they said the RIAA asked Apple to ban audio hijack. And so Steve was like, do you need this for podcasting? And Adam Curry said, currently, yes. And he said, well, then F them. We're not going to do it.
He saved.
So there, but for the.
He saved Rogue Amoeba. Yep. From an early death.
Which kind of maybe helped podcasting a bit too.
Yeah. So you think that's a credible story?
I mean, like, you never know. It's like half the the story about the iPod in the fish tank is apparently like not a true story, but like it's part of our urban mythology at this point.
Yeah.
It's our Silicon Valley lore.
It's from Adam Curry, so I have some some skepticism. It's a little self-aggrandizing, which is not unusual for Adam. Nevertheless, I wouldn't be surprised. Eddie Q reportedly told Curry, according to Adam, the RIAA wants us to disable Audio Hijack Pro because with it you could record any sound off your Mac, any song, anything. Jobs then asked whether Curry and other podcasters needed Audio Hijack. The answer was an emphatic yes. So Adam says, Steve told the RIAA to get lost. I've heard enough apocryphal stories out of Curry's mouth that I'm slightly skeptical. But, you know, it's possible. Let's talk about the other big Apple story of the week. The New York Times says that there are people at Apple who do not want them to release the goggles. At Apple, rare dissent over a new product interactive goggles. This confirms another story we'd heard from another source, I think Gurman, that the design team did not want Apple to release the AR/VR goggles this year. They wanted them to wait until sometime in the distant future that AR spectacles are possible, but that Tim Cook overruled them. I'm a little suspicious of that story as well.
Johnny canceled the previous one because it needed a whole computer dongle.
Right.
Remember when Apple did that whole show at WWDC with AMD when they showed off like how you could have like GPUs and you could do the Darth Vader, and that was all going to be slave to a box. And then Johnny's like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah. Well, and now it's slave to a battery. You have to plug in an external battery. Of course, you don't want to put the battery in the headset. We have with us, ladies and gentlemen, a strong advocate for virtual reality. Let me ask you, Georgia, would you spend $3,000 on this standalone headset? It sounds like it's somewhat like the Oculus Quest, maybe the Pro version of Quest. What do you think?
I won't say that I wouldn't. But that is a lot. Like, it really says, what is it going to do for me? How is it going to make my life better? How exciting is this experience? How comfortable is it to wear? It would
Does it
depend
have a single
upon
game?
That. Does it have a game that I really love? So I got the PlayStation 5. Stole from Renee at VR, and I'm playing Horizon on it, and I find that the headset is very strangely made up, where it's kind of like a headband and the headset fits on top, and I find it really uncomfortable. I find the gameplay wonderful, and I think that they did a great job with it, but like that they don't want it released is probably there's something that is it's not right. Like, Apple shouldn't go into the market and produce something that's going to end up being
I think that's the question. I think this is going to be a rare flop from Apple, to be honest.
I mean, traditionally, Apple has taken existing technologies and just made them slightly better. I mean, when the first iPhone came out, it was rubbish from a technical standpoint, but the interface was so good that people loved it. Same with, you know, the iPod and the rest of it.
And the Apple Watch.
Yeah. Well, I'm...
Some people are comparing it to the Apple Watch, because when the Apple Watch came out, it wasn't a huge success. But it has gone, it is now, you know, a multi-billion, probably a $20 or $30 billion business, because over time, they've added functionality. People have found ways to use it. It's gotten better and better, right? I think we'd agree that it's gotten better and better.
Yeah.
So some people are saying this is going to be like that. It's the first product. But the Apple Watch did not cost $3,000. Actually, one of them cost $24,000.
If you're going for the gold.
Yeah.
But I think that for this, it's already such a niche market. There's very few people versus a watch, where most people have a watch, most people have a phone. I think that they have to make sure that this is going to knock it out of the park. And if not, they shouldn't release it. They should wait.
I paid $1,500 for the Quest Pro. Meta has dropped the price to $1,000. Not because it's a big bestseller, I'm guessing.
No.
Which one do you like best, Georgia?
Right now, I'm using the PlayStation 5 just because of the game, not because I like the system itself. But I think that the interface is actually quite interesting, and the way that they have transformed the Horizon games in order to be really good in VR. So even though it's not the most comfortable of systems, it's easy to use. It's easy to set up. It runs on the PlayStation 5 really nicely. And for that, I think it has a really nice ease of use. And the gaming is quite well done. I just think that the headset itself is uncomfortable, especially compared to something like the Quest, where it's really easy to put on and quite comfortable. I find it hurts me, and it gives me a headache because it's a headband. And because it's so heavy, it's really strapped your head so hard, and it's not supposed to rest on your nose, which means that the little nose part that has this little fold kind of tickles my nose and causes it to become really uncomfortable. And so I keep on adjusting my headset, and so I get a migraine. But the other side of it, they do a great job on the software side to make sure that you don't get sick playing it. And so when you're doing something like sliding down a zip line, which happens quite a lot, and it's a free movement game, which causes more people, instead of a teleport where you zoom from one spot, bloop, and you pop into another spot, which you can travel quickly without getting sick, they end up changing the field of view into this kind of just a little tiny field of view every time you move very quickly, which works relatively effectively. So you don't get very much vertigo when you play. And I think that they did a good job of that.
I have another beautiful dream, and this is going to require this to be part of it. And like you can make fun of me because this might take years to happen. But I think when we get to like GPT-6 and Bard 3, and Facebook finally has their models off of the torrents and onto the real world, and we see what Apple's doing with their language models, in order to get to like, forget Star Trek for a minute, like to get to Tony Stark, like in the early Iron Man movies, even in Endgame where he's solving for time travel, you have this component of talking to a large language model. There it's Jarvis or Friday, but the other part of it is interacting with an environment. And they use holographics in the Marvel movies, obviously, but that seems like a very hard problem to solve. And it seems like a task that AR glasses might be able to do, but not for a very long time. But if you want to have a really interactive large language model experience, like generative AI experience, something that's beyond just the Zork interface, it's going to require very good natural language, spoken word parsing, but it's also going to have these virtual reality things that we can interact with. So like, of course, the games are going to be there, and the entertainment and the fitness stuff, but to be able to sit there and model things and build things out is going to require both the computer and the next generation of interface, which we haven't really gotten for this stuff yet.
We haven't solved the basic hardware problem. You know, I mean, Oculus, when, you know, 10 years ago was saying, we're going to be 15 years away from a pair of spectacles that you can put on and do this. Now, I've tried the latest Oculus kit. I gave a very overenthusiastic review on Twitter of HoloLens when it first came out. But the fact of the matter, as Georgia points out, is you've got a heavy bit of kit on your head, and the battery life is very limited. And until we solve those hardware problems, I don't see this going forward.
Do you still? I tried the PlayStation VR when it first came out, and you had to sit down. Do you still have to sit down in PlayStation VR, or can you stand up now?
the setup is actually really wonderful. So one is you can choose. It asks you whether you want to sit or if you want to stand. Two, it will track and map your room for you. That is incredible and really, really quick. And the other part is that it actually pulls you out of the game really quickly and effectively, unfortunately, a little bit too soon, into your room setup. So if you go outside before you're going to hit your TV or your wall, it's going to pull you out of the game, which stops you dead in your tracks. And then it has an eye tracking, which works really well. So you can, and which you can choose to turn on or turn off depending on what you want. And so you can kind of track with your eyes where you want to be able to click and to be able to click in and out. And so I think that its user interface is much more user-friendly and much easier to set up. So the setup is very, very quick. And to be able to flip that on or change something, so I moved a table so I'd have a little bit more space and I could just retrack it and it took seconds. And you don't have to be really technologically savvy or scan it out with the handset, which you have to do on the Vive. It really just does everything for you. And I think it does a great job of that.
So one of the big problems, of course, is movement, because we still don't have those Ready Player One every which way treadmills to go in every which way.
They do. They're very expensive.
Yeah,
they
we tried one,
in
I
all
think.
The games.
They're
did
awful.
You try one?
Yeah, they're just not a good...
They're awful.
If you thought you got sick with the glasses, why don't you try the treadmill? So it's really curious to me that Apple... It may just be because there's a certain amount of momentum. You can't change on a dime. It really appears as if VR is a flop already. Like we already know it hasn't taken off and that AI is about to just explode, but Apple can't move on a dime. They put all their eggs in the VR basket, the AR basket, and now they're kind of stuck. And meanwhile, you know, AI is leaving them in the dust. Siri is not exactly the sharpest tool in the system.
It could be worse. You look they at could the... be Facebook with a metaverse. You know, they
well, yeah, they put
Zuckerberg gambled that's on that true. One and lost out big
do
time.
You think they have? Is it, I mean, am I being premature in declaring
that? No, I think it's simpler than that. I think it's like simpler than that. I think like Apple is traditionally good at looking several years ahead. And when you look at the evolution of the Apple TV, the idea of paying like $100 for a box in the living room that everybody gets to share is probably not as enticing as people paying like right now $3,000, but eventually like $500 for a personal device you strap on your head that leverages like the movie, like all the Apple TV content they've built up, the Fitness Plus content they've built up, the educational content they've built up. Like it is becomes a personal entertainment experience, the natural evolution of like the way the iPhone replaced the iPod. They're looking at this as a convergence device to replace the Apple TV. And then the AR glasses become the device that replaces the watch. Can't do as much as the phone, like can't do as much as a headset, but it's really convenient. It's very light. You wear it. And so those two product lines they have now, Apple Watch and Apple TV, go on to like the AR headset and the VR glasses. And I wouldn't like count out Apple for AI either. Like they, Siri is like terrible, but they've got like a lot of really good AI for things. So is autocorrect. Like anything that seems to involve language is just tough. But like there's a lot of AI going on for like photos and like photography and cameras and stuff. And they have enough money that they could have been building language models for years as well. We just don't know because they don't beta test in public the way every single other right. company does. But it's quite possible that AR is AI. In fact, I would be disappointed. Kevin Sorbo level disappointed if AI wasn't part of whatever they're building for wearables, because it's the first thing that makes voice technology, like written word technology, actually usable.
It is. I mean, that then you have something of much more interesting than just a headset you wear to play games. Yeah. According to Mark Gurman of Bloomberg, Apple had an event at the Steve Jobs Theater for 100 top executives to demo the device ahead of a unveiling at WWDC in June. No word about how they reacted to the unveiling.
That tells you a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. No leaks about them jumping to their feet and cheering. I have to think Apple is running a big risk here. I don't know. What do you, am I wrong?
I don't think that they're running a risk. I think that they need to be in the game. And I think that it is a game changer. There's certain things that AI and VR, it can be very effective in. I think that there's some things that it doesn't. And I think that there's still a whole bunch of problems with setup and with weight and with the amount of processing and, you know, people feeling sick, I think that there's things that they need to be able to solve. And if they don't solve it well, I think that it's better that they wait than put it out. But I think that it is a way of a future that we can be able to do things, learn skills, take care of things, go through different situations, visit places, and experience things that you can't do in other mediums. So I think that it's there. It's just not the time yet. I think that it's a little bit ahead of its own curve.
Speaking of the watch, according again to Gurman, the Apple Watch with glucose sensing is up to 7 years away from launch. I'm not surprised.
Type 1 diabetic, and she was very very hopeful initially, but yeah, it's not looking good.
Yeah,
they spoke about that years ago. Like they said that they thought they were close, and they ended up being a lot longer out. They kept buying companies that kept saying within a year we'll have it, and every company they bought swore that. And then it turned out they were years and years away, and it just looked like a very very hard problem to solve.
Is it time to short Apple stock? Have they finally reached their peak?
I've stopped giving stock advice because I was asked by a mate when Google went public, you know, should I invest in Google? And I was like, no, there'll be a better search engine along in a year, 2 years.
Microsoft is relevant again, right? Like Microsoft came out of like...
it's still a sore point for him. But
yeah. I mean, look, even if... So their plan is to release this headset for $3,000. I mean, it's aimed at, I guess, at developers and companies and people want to see what they can do with it. It's not a consumer product yet. They aren't going to make a whole lot of them. They expect to sell about a million, which for Apple's nothing. That would make
it. Is it the $600 iPhone or the $600 HomePod?
That's a good question, isn't it? And of course, Bloomberg rubs salt in the wound by posting this picture in the article of a Meta Quest Pro headset with a guy who looks like an absolute dork using it.
He doesn't look bad. It's the hands.
Why? Yeah. What's he doing? Is he playing the piano?
Why does he have the velociraptor hands?
Yeah, that's it.
He's doing the Wednesday Addams dance.
Almost universally, stock art with people in VR headsets makes them look like idiots, but that's kind of what you
look
like.
Why didn't we learn from anime? We've got like 40 years of anime to draw on cool headsets from.
You always think you're cooler looking than you are when you're there.
When you're wearing it, you feel pretty cool. Yeah. You're like in this amazing world. Do you think, Georgia, that without...
I feel kind of sweaty, but no. It's...
Yeah, well, do you think true. Without games that Apple, it's a non-starter? You think you have to have a game to sell these?
I think the games help because that's what we've traditionally been using it for. But if they have a great AI interface where... You know, it's kind of that Terminator world where you're able to find out information that you need. If it actually increases, like gives you more time, is able to do things so that you can do things more effectively, more efficiently, more effortlessly, then it would be another way of going through it. But it's always that thing of changing people's perception of how they do things. It's really hard to be able to do. And so that's why it would be faster to be able to do it through gaming. That's more because we're like we have these prehistoric brains where we get stuck on one way of doing things and change is hard for us.
Yeah.
I just needed to make a particle I can use to power my arc reactor so I stop turning green.
It feels like you have to have a killer
app. Never
going to
be that cool.
If you're going to sell a $3,000 headset, there's got to be at least one thing that you want to do in it. And I don't want to meet people in virtual reality, even if Apple could figure out how to put legs on them.
They have a very different philosophy. Like Facebook really, well, at least like from what Facebook had said, they really want us to live in the metaverse. They want us to have meetings and converse and do shopping. Where Tim Cook, I forget where he said it, but he's like, we want it to be like TV. You put it on, you have an enjoyable experience, you take it off and you interact with humans again. And they have like a fundamental difference in vision for what that technology should do than Facebook.
But I think that's why Meta failed so poorly is that it is a, And whenever you do something, be it a game or not, it has to be better than it is in reality, because if not, why do it? And for wearing a headset and not being able to have the facial reactions be appropriate and things are weird, it right away pulls you out of the meeting. It's distracting. It's uncomfortable. It's heavy. And so that's where Meta was never going to, sorry for people that are into it, but like it was never going to happen. It's just the wrong situation for something that's wrong. It's much better to do something on Zoom where you can actually see people closer to real time. The facial reactions, which are so important for social interactions, are accurate. And so because of that, we're getting all of these force feedings and people's hands are floating around and their bodies look weird. And so you can't really relax and be able to deal with the meeting, and you're uncomfortable and you have to itch and there's something on your eye and it's suddenly fuzzy and you've created condensation and you can't find the little tiny cloth to be able to clean your eye thing. And then your head's fallen off because you've taken your headset off. You have to go to the washroom. Everyone notices that your head's floating around. Like, these are
things. Why do you do this to yourself?
It's not.
That was the Verge meeting, right? They filmed Neelai and Alex and everybody like doing the Horizon meeting, and it was just like their eyes bugging out.
It's awful.
It's not good. It's not good.
It's really awful. Yeah.
I want
it to be like Terminator. I want it to be able to give me all the stats and information of everything that I interact with.
Are you
how to kill it, how to deal
shirt?
With it, how to buy it, where it is on Amazon. Like, I want that kind of information at my fingertips. And I want it to be comfortable. And I want myself to look cooler, not less cool, while I wear it. If it doesn't solve these problems, it's not going to be something that I'm going to wear for long periods of time.
I got to decide whether to spend $3,000 on it. I mean, I have a reason to do it, which is so we can talk about it. But I'm really reluctant to spend that much. I already spent $1,500 on a Quest Pro that, you know, I am really reluctant to spend twice that on an Apple headset that will be.
I mean, $3,000 is a lot to shell out. And I think one of the things that Microsoft found with HoloLens was, you can build the hardware, but unless you've got the apps, people
gotta
aren't
have the
come
apps.
For it.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to get the US military sold on this and they tried it out and said, this is going to get soldiers killed. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, they've been trying it with the engineering field, surprisingly not pushing it for gamers. I mean, Georgia, I'm curious about your thoughts on this, but I mean, you would have thought, you know, Halo saved Xbox.
Yes.
So
yes.
Why is this not something for HoloLens?
One Halo, because of Horizon is why I got the PlayStation VR, was just for that game, because I love Horizon. It's a really great game. It's quite well done. It's more of a climby game, like you're climbing a lot of the time, so it's a little bit disappointing. But that's what I got it for. And so I think that if they had Halo, and again, that could be a really great experience in VR, especially more hand-to-hand combat. Like if we end up having like some sort of like a Vorpal Sword, like that's just an awesome feeling and it's a great workout at the same time. People would purchase it. But without that, then you have to offer something that is better than what you would do naturally and interact with naturally in the real world. And so what would be better than that? Because I can't fight people in the real world. I enjoy doing it in gaming. I can't control different, you know, robotics and be able to build things and work in a mech. Like these are things that people would enjoy doing in VR. If they don't have that, I don't see it being a wide mass appeal. And they have to be able to make it profitable. And so then it ends up being something that's very niche, not very profitable. And then people have to warm up to doing things differently. And even just changing a steering wheel on a car ends up having a whole bunch of critical reviews, even if it's a better way to handle a steering wheel, because we're already used to it. We don't want the extra overhead of having to learn something new. So if they don't end up solving for the problem of our own human biology of the way that we work things, then it's not going to be successful.
Yeah. Two of my biggest questions in technology was why Microsoft never made an Xbox phone instead of a Windows phone, just had it in carrier stores with Xbox and branding right next to an iPhone and a Samsung phone, and why they didn't make a Halo lens instead of a HoloLens and had it like on all the shelves. Like, it just seems like those were such a better, stronger consumer brand, right? Like
they
sold, but they want to sell Windows to kids.
It looks like the helmet.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
then? Like, if it looks it's, like the marketing
that
does
would
itself.
Be awesome. I could,
wouldn't that be awesome?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
I would love that. I would wear it just out because you would look so cool.
They'd probably sell quite a few units to cosplayers. You're exactly right. They want to be Master Chief.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, we got the helmet already. Why not? Absolutely.
Everyone
would
wear it.
I want a Master Chief helmet.
No, I was just saying, I mean, coming to your point, Renee, about mobile gaming firms, I think the N-Gage scared a lot of companies off that because, you know, all this work was put into doing a handset which could play games and it died on its backside.
It turned out the iPhone was an amazing gaming machine. And like,
who knew?
I'm just saying branding, like brand it. Brand it like an Xbox for the kids.
So
it would have bought way more than the Office people.
Speaking of which, it looks like the EU is going to force Apple to open up its app store, and Microsoft is already planning, apparently, we've talked about this before, a store that would allow you to by Microsoft games, or it'll be a competing store with the App Store, I guess, right? They won't be the only ones. I think there are probably quite a few other companies, including Epic, that want to do app stores in the on the iPhone. You think this is going to be a – this is not probably till next spring, right, or next year at some point. But that's going to be
interesting. The EU is actually taking the move on this rather than the American. Yeah. You know, it's just like we've seen this time and again. When it comes to enforcement, you go to the EU. But yeah, you know, honestly, the App Store thing is the idea that you've just got to pay over 30% or 15% as it is now is just, it's basic rent seeking.
Right.
I just found it like super disappointing. Like, a lot of this could have, I don't know, like, I obviously I don't run Apple. I don't have those responsibilities. I don't know everything that's involved. But it just seems like with a lot of these things, like the iPhone was always designed to be a console. Like from the very first time they announced the SDK, it was clear like this is not an open computing platform. This is a console. But they stuck with it. And in 30% back then wasn't very much. But like things change over the years. And it seems like either just allowing people to buy things over the web, like just like you have to use the App Store on the phone, but you can go make your payments on the web if you want to get Netflix or you want to get Amazon book. Like, there seems like a whole bunch of steps that could have been taken that would mitigate all of this. And let's say we're like supremely confident they would win and would never be challenged, even if they changed nothing for 50 years. It just seems like a bad bet to make, especially when, and this goes for a lot of companies, all the stuff that ends up hurting them is not their core business. Like the App Store is super successful, but it's not where Apple makes their money. It's not their core product.
And it's yet, a like, big part of these, the services revenue overall. Though, isn't it? A big part of the service.
Yeah, but like services revenue is still like compared to like iPhone money. Like it's nothing to bet the company. Maybe it is. Like again, like I'm ignorant about this stuff. Maybe it is something to bet the company over. But just like letting them do web payments would have taken so much of the pressure away from this. And now it's going to be forced to be another. And the thing that like kind of bugs me a little bit is that as nerds, we have everything. Like we have Linux and Windows and the Mac and Android. And there's like a couple products that like people who just want a computing appliance have. They have like iPads and Chromebooks basically. And like we look at these things and salivate and say the hardware is nice. We want them to be nerd products too. And then we make them complicated to the point where I've seen my parents' iPads, Leo. They're nightmares now. They used to be like these simple computers they could use. Now they have 18 versions of Mail open at all times and don't even know that they're open. Like it's just like they're no longer consumer friendly. They're no longer nerd friendly. And I worry that we've sort of taken away an option from the market that we won't be able to give back to the mainstream computing people for whom they were designed.
Let's take a little break. We have a bunch of final thoughts, final stories, including some very, very good news about Mr. and Mrs. Pickles. But before we do that, let me tell you about Shopify. There's that sound, the sound of another sale on Shopify, the moment another person's business dream becomes a reality. Our show today brought to you by Shopify. Yeah, I have a kind of a soft spot for Shopify because I was talking about my son, the chef. He was able to build an amazing website. It made it easy. He didn't know anything about building a website or selling online, but as soon as he was able to set it up with Shopify. And I asked Hank, I said, how important has Shopify been to your business? He said, it's everything. I had no idea how to do this. Shopify gave me a beautiful website that I could sell. In fact, he's been selling salt like crazy. It's sold out almost as soon as he can create it. Shopify is very empowering technology. No matter how big you want to grow, Shopify handled, all of a sudden, a huge amount of traffic. He sold a ton of salt. Shopify is there to empower you with the confidence and control to take your business to the next level. Whether you're selling fedoras or bike helmets, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person so you can focus on successfully growing your business. Shopify covers every sales channel from an in-person point-of-sale system. Yeah, you can use it in the real world, in IRL. To an all-in-one e-commerce platform like Hank's. It even lets you sell across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. And I can tell you, Hank's been using that too. Packed with industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth, Shopify gives you complete control over your business and your brand without having to learn any new skills in design or code. Thanks to 24/7 help and an extensive business course library, Shopify's there to support your success every step of the way. It's not just my son. My daughter also has a Shopify site. It's the whole family is doing it on Shopify. Thank you, Shopify, for empowering the LaPorte children's kind of amazing getting off of dad's payroll plan. Very well done. Couldn't have done it without Shopify. Love Shopify for so many reasons. I want you to check it out. We're going to help you get started with Shopify. Sign up for $1 a month trial period, $1 a month at shopify.com/twit. Now's your turn to get serious about selling and try Shopify today. This is possibility powered by Shopify. It blows me away. Go to shopify.com/twit, all lowercase, to take your business to the next level today. Shopify.com/twit. This really, to me, is the promise of the internet, to give anybody the chance to sell online to a global marketplace, a global audience, to build beautiful websites that really work. Hank's done it. Abby's done it. Maybe you're next. Shopify.com/twit. Get that $1 a month trial period started right now. What are you going to sell on Shopify? Let us see.
Not the Twitter source code. That would be wrong.
Don't sell it. Don't sell it. Here's Kara Swisher's tweet. Intelligence has its limitations, but stupidity is infinite. Twitter says part of its source code was leaked online Friday night. They were appealing to GitHub to take it down. Remember that Musk promised to release, to open source the algorithm? But then he fired anybody who knew how to do it.
Musk promises a lot of things. And one of the things, the thing that this showed up was, you know, if you fire half the company, someone's going to get really antsy about it.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, stupidity, but it easily observable that it was going to happen.
I don't know what you would do with the source code. I don't know how valuable that is.
Find exploits they're worried about.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened to LastPass, right? The hack of LastPass began with something seemingly innocuous. They said, oh, don't worry about it. They just got into our source code repositories. But it was the beginning of the big hack, right? So, yeah I think this is always a cause for concern. Speaking of Elon, Semaphore has the story of how Elon left OpenAI. Remember, Elon Musk, along with Reid Hoffman, joined Sam Altman, formerly of Y Combinator, to form OpenAI, a nonprofit in 2015. The idea is the group pledged $1 billion to take development of artificial intelligence out of the closed private hands of companies like Google and to do it in public, right? In early 2018, Musk told Sam Altman, current CEO of OpenAI, that he believed the venture had fallen fatally behind Google. Google's beaten us. He proposed a possible solution. This is, by the way, Reid Albergati's scoop on Semaphore. Good job, Reid. He was on a couple of weeks ago. Elon said, let me take control of OpenAI and run it myself. Apparently, Sam knew something about Elon that we didn't know until recently and said no. They rejected his proposal. Musk walked away from the company, reneged on a massive planned donation. So he's no longer a part of OpenAI. Maybe he wishes he was.
Reid said, tweeting about it earlier this week. Yeah, just like, I gave all this money to an open source charity and now it's a profit.
Well, he's got a point there. OpenAI is no longer a open project. It's a for-profit project, right?
Oh no, I mean, they're hugely Microsoft funded, and it's entirely for profit.
Yep.
I mean, they've got a fig leaf charitable side, which is about as useful as, you know, a fifth leg.
It's not where ChatGPT is coming from, that's for sure. Elon did finally come through on his stock grants. Remember, he'd promised stock options to any employees that stayed at Twitter. He is, unfortunately, though, valuing the company at about $20 billion, less than half what he paid for it.
I'm still not convinced he wasn't having a really good doobie and he just thought, I'll buy it.
Yeah. And you know what? He's probably accurate. The 20 billion is a lot closer to the actual value. He did email the staff saying he's optimistic about the future. I see a clear but difficult path to a greater than 250 billion valuation. Meaning stock graded
now. Hanging out on wallets. He wants that to be a currency exchange, like a, what's it called, an everything app.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if he really wants it to be that, or he's just like everything else, talking off, shooting off the hip.
I mean, listen, I want a rainbow unicorn that passes pure neat, pure real ale, but it's not going to happen.
I ordered one of those on Indiegogo about 7 or 8 years ago, and I never got it.
Georgia got the last one.
Did she? Darn it.
Sorry, all mine.
Shucks. Hey, before we get to the final stories of the day, I want to remind you that this is a all week long network with lots of shows besides Twit. In fact, we've made a little mini movie to tease you about some of the things you might have missed this week. Watch. Let's see. Imagine Leo Laporte being arrested after his bank heist. Here I am being arrested. And I'm
not happy about it.
In a sweater vest.
Which one you were right? You and your britches.
Me and my britches.
Mom jeans.
Yeah.
Mom jeans.
I've never seen you with denim.
Previously on Twit. Twit News.
I thank our systems, cloud, and software partners, and especially our amazing employees, for building the NVIDIA accelerated computing ecosystem.
That's the NVIDIA GTC keynote. And as you know, we predicted, NVIDIA is firing on all cylinders in every area, and AI has just accelerated their growth. They're working with all the players. They're creating hardware that almost everybody uses, even competitors like Google and Microsoft.
Home theater geeks.
Of course, I care deeply about audio and the quality of audio reproduction. And I can certainly hear the difference between good audio and bad audio. But there are several reasons why I don't think of myself as an audiophile and why I don't spend a ton of money on it.
This Week in Enterprise Tech.
This PC Magazine article, it sounds like the script from a 007 film. Someone in Ecuador has resorted to creating flash drives designed to explode once they connect to a computer.
Twit. It's not your father's Twit.
One more reason not to stick a hard drive or a USB thumb drive you found in the street into your computer. There's bad things that can happen. We thank, by the way, our Club Twit members for making Home Theater Geeks possible. They brought it back with their donations. Because your $7 a month helps us in so many ways, we're able to launch new shows. This Week in Space came out of the club. We do Hands on Macintosh and Hands on Windows now in the club with Paul Thurrott and Micah Sargent. We do the Untitled Linux Show and the GizFizz. And yes, we just reintroduced Home Theater Geeks. Not only do you get shows we don't put out anywhere else, you get ad-free versions of all of our shows. You also get access to the Club Twit Discord, which is full of great stuff, including a lot of Midjourney, when there's some animated GIFs. And a bunch of Midjourney stuff. We have our own Midjourney channels, and including these ones of me going to prison. You know, I didn't want to go to prison.
You didn't go easily.
I didn't go easily. I fought it. I think we took the. I think at one point. Oh yeah, I know where it is. I think Anthony took the ones that were fake of Donald Trump and put my head on it. Actually, I think I wore it better. To be honest,
I think honestly, Leo, you should put your head on the Pope fake one, you know, with a puffy jacket.
Fake? Darn it. I'm mad now. I saw the Pope in a puffy jacket and I thought, that is really cool. That is
my understanding is that's fake, but I may be wrong.
I'm going to ask Robert. Oh, man. See, it's already started where you see stuff and you don't know. Is it real? Is it memory?
Have you seen the videos where they have the deep fake presidents playing Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons?
No.
And
so
they have
like Trump.
They have Trump. Yeah, so they basically, you hear like Discord coming on and then there's like Trump, Obama, Biden, sometimes people else wearing their gamer headsets. And like, let's hurry up and do this or Michelle's not going to let me play anymore. All right, we're going to tier rank the Transformers. Optimus Prime, he's S tier. No, he's not Sleepy Joe. He's clearly D tier. Donald, would you like, and they just like, they yell at each other the way you would expect them to, but as friends who get together and game with each other all the time. time when their wives and like their families allow it.
Of course.
It's like it's way funnier than it has any rights to be.
Of course.
Oh, I need to.
I don't know if these are deep fakes or just good Photoshops, but
the voices are deep fakes.
Oh, are they? Let's see. All right. I'm going to turn on this. Yeah. Will you promise that you guys at YouTube won't take us down if I turn this on? No, you can't promise that.
Well, you know who to call.
Yeah, I know.
Renee! We fought. I don't think you know how to operate a keyboard.
Oh, f*** you, Donald. I'm getting you banned.
Okay, we got it right at the right place.
Oh, that's brilliant.
We'll just stop right there, shall we?
Yeah, the longer versions where they play like D&D games or Magic the Gathering games and they argue about their decks and Obama has like cards that should be illegal now and others have like overpowered. It's just...
Hey, we gotta
I wish they were like that in real life.
This is my night sorted now. I need to watch this.
I really want to find out if the puffy jacket... I guess they wouldn't have a white papal puffer jacket. Would probably not really be real.
Probably not. It seems like it's AI, but, you know, then again, it is the Pope. You know, he has the Pope with the 6 inches of bulletproof glass around it because there's faith in action. But, yeah.
I guess that's a fake. You know, this just shows you how it's gotten to the point where I have no critical faculties at all. I saw it and I go, well, that's cool. They made him a puffer jacket. That's fake.
We finally know not to believe anything. It took the advent of AI for us to realize not to believe things.
I should have known. I mean, come on. The Pope's not going to have a puffer jacket. He doesn't need a puffer jacket.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, the current Pope is may. When I first saw it, I was kind of like, yeah, okay. He's progressive, forward-thinking. He might be the person to drag the Catholic Church kicking and screaming into the 20th century. But, you know, it was just like, puffer jacket. Yeah, that doesn't ring right. And the cross on the outside. Dead giveaway.
It's a miter too far.
I like the tweet from Jake Flores. Hey, oh, blessed be. some good news. I like to end the show with good news. Here's some good news stories. You want to feel good? Here we go. The feel good section of the show.
Excellent.
FTC has decided it wants to ban those tough to cancel gym and cable subscriptions. The proposed click to cancel rule would require companies make it as easy to cancel a membership as it was to sign up. They're putting out a request for comments.
I'm right.
They haven't made the rule yet. I can't imagine anybody not agreeing with it except the cable companies and the phone companies and all the other companies that don't want
newspapers.
You to cancel.
You have to call them. You have to call them. You can sign up for 3 seconds on the front newspaper. We have to call them up to cancel it.
Do you remember that vid, the recording that the tech journo made where he was trying to cancel his Comcast subscription? 20 minutes they made him go through.
So here's some of the things. First of all, it'll be the business has to offer the same way to cancel service as they did to sign up. If it was a single button, you got to have a single button cancel. If the company is going to offer you special deals or perks, they're allowed to do that, but they must offer an upfront opt-out that lets customers bypass the sales pitches. Love that. That upsell is nuts. They also have to annually remind customers they're enrolled in an auto-renewal option, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things Apple does right in its App Store, they list all your subscriptions. You can easily cancel them. Well, you'll have to be notified before those renew. How many times have you gotten a renewal and went, I still have that? I still subscribe.
I had a guy come to my door yesterday. Like, he got into my building somehow, came to my door, knocked on it. It was a salesperson for the local cable company. I said, I'm already a customer. He yelled at me for not listening to him. Told me like I was a terrible client, ruined his day, and stormed off. So I contacted them and they said, well, you can take home visits. You can fill out this form to prevent home visits, but you have to refill it out every 12 months.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
The FTC is asking for comment. Presumably, the comments will be positive and they will make a rule. I hope. I'm praying. I'm counting on that.
They seem to be gearing up for action now, which is good.
Yes.
Because we need some
regulation. Thank you, Lena Khan. When you see this main license plate, LUVTOFU, I hear that laugh. I know what you're seeing. This guy loves tofu, okay? His name is Peter Starostecki. He is a vegan. He got the license approved but got an email from the state of Maine saying, no. No, you cannot have Love Tofu as your license plate.
Love to follow up?
Yeah, that's it. his appeal was rejected because the plates have to be looked at without context. The fact that there's a vegan driving does not enter in to the whole thing. So just remember, love to F you. I mean, love tofu.
But isn't that equally, like, the context is equal either way. It's inference on the other person's side that determines.
That says more about the other person than.
Yeah. It says more about the state than him.
So not going to allow the letter F in people's, license plates?
F, no.
I've seen much worse things than that.
I agree.
Like, they allow to have people have, like, full banners telling, presidents and other public officials to die or to
state-issued license plate, right?
What if it was H8 tofu? Would that be okay?
H8TOFU.
Yeah.
He should apply for that. I'll apply for that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And good news for Mr. and Mrs. Pickles. These are 90-year-old tortoises. At the Houston Zoo, they are an endangered species. They've been together since 1996, and now they are proud parents of three new baby tortoises, Dill, Gherkin, and Jalapeno.
Maybe this is what's inspiring Rupert Murdoch.
This is from the New York Times, my friends. It was an astounding feat, zoo officials say, not only because Mr. Pickles is 90 years old, but also because the critically endangered species rarely produces offspring. Might be related to the fact that they're endangered. Mr. Pickles has been at the zoo for 36 years, partnered with Mrs. Pickles. She's young. She's only 53 since her arrival in 96. Radiated tortoises can live for up to 150 years. So like Rupert Murdoch, he's really only in the first half of his life. But it's unknown.
The show came full circle.
It's unknown how long they can reproduce, but we know 92 is not out. They're looking how little they are. They're cute.
Having seen on YouTube the videos of Galapagos turtles mating, it scars you for life.
Oh, I've seen it in person.
I've never heard sounds like that before.
Yeah. No, those Galapagos turtles they're big. They're massive.
Yeah, they're creatures of legend.
Absolutely huge.
I was
the Oliphants of turtles.
I should see if I could find this picture. I was taking a picture of one on the Galapagos with my long lens when he started to approach me. And then the guides had told us, you can't touch him. Don't approach him. Stay away from him. I said, he's coming towards me. They said, don't move. I said, he's getting closer. They said, don't move.
They move so slowly.
But it's got a charge. It's got a charge stack. Yeah. Did you see those shorts of the hippo attacks where you see a hippo and then suddenly it's 800 feet tall and coming out of the water at you?
They're fast. Mammals can be on the water. They're terrifying. But
no, hippos
the Galapagos
are fast.
Turtles aren't. And it's so funny because I went to Galapagos and I saw the Galapagos turtles and we're not allowed to touch them and they're in danger. They're very careful.
They're beautiful.
But in Florida, you can breed them. You can actually buy one, take it home, breed it. Sell it to other people. I did the Galapagos. We paid for a special tour of the turtles.
Ladies and gentlemen, Florida.
I fed the turtles, pet the turtles. It followed me around because I had a very colorful skirt, so it very slowly followed me around. And then they keep the male and female turtles separate because they sometimes fight. And it was adorable because these two male turtles that have been together for 35 years and have animosity towards each other would be aggressive towards each other. So one would bite, but it was so slow and it was going to bite the other and the other would just move out of its way. And then the other would be angry and it was so slow. It was hilarious. It was just...
They live on guavas. You probably noticed this. And they're very messy eaters. So they always have a lot of guava on their face.
I fed them. There were these reeds that they also fed them. And so I got to feed them these reeds really, really slowly. But it was kind of hilarious.
This is the little baby.
Heroes in a half show.
This is Mr. Pickles' little baby. And apparently, according to the Times, the births were even more improbable because the hatchlings likely would not have survived if a zookeeper hadn't noticed Mrs. Pickles laying her eggs. The soil in Houston isn't conducive to keeping the burrowed eggs that Madagascar native turtles lay at the, lay at the right temperature and humidity. So the keepers had to take them and move them to the reptile and amphibian home. The new trio will remain behind the scenes until they're big enough to join their parents. Congratulations to Mr.
Park scientists
and Mrs. Pickles. There are Mr. and Mrs. Pickles eating some celebratory lettuce.
Well, they, they worked hard.
They worked hard.
Good for them.
Deserve some lettuce.
Tortoises are pretty amazing, I have to say. But not as amazing as you three. What a great show. Thank you so much. Georgia Dow, I've got your videos. Anxiety-videos.com. She, of course, does great. I think her YouTube videos are hysterical.
Thank you.
They're not supposed to be comedic, probably, but...
They're fun. They're supposed to be fun. I actually thought when you said Mr. and Mrs. Pickles, I thought you were talking about the Puss in Boots movie.
Oh.
You just covered that. And so I was thinking that that's where it was from. And I'm like, that seems strange. I'm like, why are we... I guess, okay. We could be covering that. So,
I want to watch. I got to watch your Therapist Reacts to Last of Us because I loved Last of Us.
Was so good.
Yeah. And I want to see what you have to say about
that. It was quite good.
Yeah.
It was quite good.
Yeah.
Though I'm not wearing any ears in that, but one of them is I dress up a little. So one of them
You dress up as Wednesday Addams, which is.
I do.
Really,
I have a few Wednesday Addams.
Really good. Yeah. You are an excellent Wednesday Addams.
Thank you. Thank you. I do try.
You make Girl Scout cookies out of proper Girl Scouts? So.
I did a little, actually, and it's horrible.
Oh.
It's horrible. Ew. It's terrible. It's terrible. But I made, the ears for all the characters for, I glued together the little tiny ears for if you saw the Puss in Boots movie, you'll understand it's Perito. But it's
so
just
cute.
Fun.
What you do is so cute.
It is true.
There she is in her ears.
Oh, there's I am with my ears.
Aww.
I'm Perito.
Perito.
He's so cute.
So you will both laugh, love, and learn with her videos. They're so good. I wish I had been watching your videos as I watched Last of Us because you've gone through all the episodes. So I have to go back.
I did go through all the episodes. Yeah, it was so good. I really enjoyed that.
I agree. Episode 3, it couldn't stop crying. Couldn't stop crying. Nope.
I think that they should have had another 2 or 3 episodes. I think
agree.
That it was short in comparison to how much they had in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig Mazin could write. Who would have thunked it?
Well, that's what's interesting, right? The themes of the game ended up being excellent themes for a television series. I thought that was fascinating.
One thing I heard that was really interesting was that one editor, the main editor, had never seen it. So he cut the whole thing without never playing the video game.
Oh.
Just trying to figure out. But the co-editor had was an ultra fan and would go through it and look at it after to make sure he didn't forget anything or something wasn't done better in the... in the game, but they said it ended up being cut very similar to the game just because that was the best way to tell the story.
Interesting. Wow. Well, Georgia Dow is at youtube.com at Georgia Dow. Renee Ritchie is at youtube.com/@Renee Ritchie. And of course, he's the creator liaison over there. So if you're a YouTube creator, you will be talking to Mr. Ritchie. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Leo.
Anything you want to plug?
I did a video. If you go to the creator, youtube.com/@YouTubeLiaison, I recently got to interview Mr. Beast, Jimmy Donaldson, about multi-language audio on YouTube, where you can now upload, if you dub tracks, you don't have to have a separate Spanish channel or a separate French channel or Portuguese channel. You can upload multiple audio tracks to the same channel, and then it will automatically pick the one that goes with the language preference of the viewer.
That's super cool. So he has Portuguese and Spanish, and that's really, really cool. Good for him. And of course, Ian Thompson, he is U.S. editor at theregister.com. Always a pleasure, Ian. When you used to come up here, you used to go to the English store and pick up some last minute Marmite.
Finding Marmite. My fellow, I went to a British bloke's leaving do last night, Dave Lee, who's going over to Bloomberg in New York. And we have a competition. Who can find the most expensive Marmite? And my goodness, California really comes through.
We have the most expensive Marmite?
Oh, yeah. I was charged $8 for a tiny little thing. Whereas, with Amazon, I can actually buy the catering size packs. So
God, how much Marmite do you eat?
I go through about 1 kilogram a year.
A kilogram a year? of you get basically the byproduct of beer making. Yum, yum, yum. Oh, look, Sanitarium brand Marmite from New Zealand.
Now you see that tasting tank on the right-hand side.
Here's the 600-gram tubs, pack of two for $48. That's a lot of Marmite.
I have it at the moment.
But, you know, However, a spreadable tub is a good idea, I think.
Well, honestly, the lids on those are really bad because one of them fell off on the shelf and went on its side, and I didn't notice it for a day or two.
Yeah.
And it looked like Venom 3, the remake. You know, just patched up everywhere.
That's great. Let's eat that.
Well, a mate of mine did say, I bet you clean that up with toast. But yeah,
that's the easiest way to do it. Absolutely. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Georgia. Thank you, Renee. Always a pleasure. Thanks also to Cory Doctorow, who joined us earlier. And thanks to all of you who put up with us every Sunday for This Week in Tech. We do the show Sunday afternoons right after Ask the Tech Guys. I throw Micah bodily out of the studio, and then we do This Week in Tech about 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. You can watch us do it live at live.twit.tv. If you're watching live, you can chat with us live at irc.twit.tv. Of course, Club Twit members have the Discord where they can chat, which is awesome. We love having you in there. After the fact, the website has shows. You can download them there or go to YouTube. We have a YouTube channel. Actually, probably the best thing is go to the main Twit channel, youtube.com/@twit. And then you can follow links to all the shows. Each show has its own channel, including This Week in Tech. And maybe the easiest thing to do is just find a good podcast program and subscribe. That way you'll get it the minute it's available of a Sunday evening. Reminder, I will be taking the next few weeks off. Micah Sargent will be taking over next Sunday, Devinder Hardwar following that. And on the 16th, Jason Howell, I'll be back on the 23rd. Thanks to all the people who behind the scenes who make, I never thank you guys. I should really thank you. Benito, who runs the board, John and Burke, who run the studio. Kevin King, our editor, usually, pardon me? Not today. Who will be editing the show? Will Benito? Anthony Nielsen. Of course, Anthony's kind of our creative director. Does a lot of great things. You know what? There is a crawl at the end of the show that shows all the people. It is not an easy thing to put this together every week. And I am eternally grateful to all the people who help and do it. And of course, Aunt Pruitt filling in for Jason Howell, who's in Costa Rica this week. And Aunt did the production on this show. So thank you, Aunt Pruitt. Thanks to all of you. We'll see you next time. But meanwhile, another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.
This is amazing.